is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
That's right. I'm your ambassador of the unexplained. It's Micah Hanks. Welcome to the program, your weekly Graylian Report. Joined in studio, as always, by our producer extraordinaire, the one and only, the legend himself, the holy half-dead Mr. Chris Hayes. Chris, how are you?
I'm pretty good, but you're the holy half-dead, Micah.
What? I'm holy something, hopefully.
I've got the picture to prove it.
I've got holes in my shoes, maybe. Sitting directly behind him on the master console here at Graylian International Headquarters, a console with more buttons than most people would know what to do with. Fortunately, he's got a couple of tentacles that come out from under his arms. Mr. Matt Oakley, our engineer. Good evening, Mr. Matt Oakley. How are you?
Who the hell told you I was here?
Oh, sorry. I forgot. I turned around and, well, there he was, here at the Master Starship. It's not the Enterprise. This is more like the Starship, well, I don't know. We'll have to come up with a name. Maybe we'll make that one of our poll questions for this evening, because you, my dear listeners, are about to join us on a wild romp through the strange and mystical realm of the esoteric. It is the Graylian Report, your weekly hub for the strange and unusual. Thank you for, again, making this Tuesday, this particular night of the week, your favorite stop, and, of course, making us the place that you choose to land on. Without further ado, we will continue now into our foray into the dark realm of the web that you rely on every week for your strange news, anomalies, and weirdness from beyond the fringe. Right off the bat, I want to direct you, if you haven't been to the website yet in the last couple of days, we've got all kinds of great stuff, goodies for you over there at www.graylianreport.com. All you got to do to find the website is just visit www.graylian, that's G-R and the word alien, graylianreport.com. We've got some good stuff up there. For instance, let me tell you about this one. Matt Oakley, our engineer, he doesn't just sit back there and push buttons on Tuesday nights. No, Mr. Matt Oakley's been quite busy this week, and Anomalous.com actually linked to his article with a White House respond, notes and asides from the news desk of Matthew Oakley. We'll tell you what Matt had to say here in just a few minutes, and in the meantime, you can get a sneak peek by going to GraylianReport.com, reading up on that. I've also got a piece that we've done, Singular Semantics, Valet and the Origins of Technological Singularity. If you are a regular listener of this program, you already know what singularity is and what it has to do with this program, why it's something of interest to us here on the Graylian Report. I'll tell you this, we talked about it a little bit on our Mac Tawney's tribute last week, and we're going to be touching on it again tonight. And our special field correspondent guest in Hour 2, Caleb Hanks, will be joining us to talk about a little feud that's been going on. There have been some folks who've tried to debunk the mad prophet of not the airwaves, but of transhumanism. That's right, Ray Kurzweil, author of The Singularity Is Near. Well, he has had a rebuttal that he has issued regarding people trying to debunk what he says is going to be happening within the next couple of decades. And what Kurzweil says is going to happen is going to be big. But let me tell you, he's not the only one who's saying this. In fact, well, I'll tell you what, if you want to find out who all else has been speculating for several decades now that there's going to be something really big. I'm talking about Earth changing. It's going to affect us as a species. It's going to affect life as we know it. And guys like Kurzweil and Jacques Vallée and Werner Vinge, the sci-fi writer, are all saying that this is going to happen in the next couple of decades. It's the singularity. Now, hey, I don't know. In fact, I'd rather not have an opinion on the matter. I'm just here to report the facts to you. You, my dear listeners, can decide for yourselves exactly what's actually going on, but we're certainly going to have our field correspondent, Caleb Hanks, joining us during Hour 2 to discuss the implications of singularity and also this news story and how Kurzweil has handled the rebuttal in terms of people trying to debunk his theories. But before we get to all that, we have a very strange story. This is kind of an ongoing story out of British Columbia, and we've been following this one here at the Graylian Report. A lot of news programs and websites have been following this particular story. It's really creepy. I'm sure some of you have probably heard about this already. It has to do with feet, okay, human feet washed ashore, okay, on parts of the West Coast. Now, I've heard all kinds of speculation previously as to what exactly might be going on here. And one of the theories, get this, people are saying it might be a serial killer out there, somebody who for some reason has a foot fetish. But that's not the latest development in this story, apparently, right now. Although there's been speculation about why human feet have been washing on shore on the West Coast. Well, the Daily Mail out of the UK today reported, has the mystery of the feet washed ashore in British Columbia finally been solved? Apparently, a foot was identified as belonging to a woman recently who, it is known, jumped to her death from a bridge. DNA confirmation remains to be found belonging to a woman who also jumped from a bridge in 2004. Her feet were found 6 months apart in different parts of the same river. The theory is that all the limbs belonged now, they say, to suicide victims, and they say that seems likely. Now, as I understand, there have been 12 severed feet which have washed ashore in parts of Canada and along the West Coast. And though they're saying that these could indeed be suicide victims, it still is pretty eerie, the entire situation. I mean, guys, for real, 12 instances where human feet have washed on shore on the West Coast. And they're saying that these are all probably suicide victims whose bodies, I guess, getting washed around, you know, and predators, you know, tearing them apart and things like that out in the waters. It causes the feet to appear on the shore by themselves, appearing only as though they've been removed perhaps from a body. What do you think?
Well, are we talking about 12 feet or 12 pairs of feet?
I think, as I understand this, we're talking about 12 individual severed feet. Now, two of these feet that have been discovered apparently belong to one woman, and it is known that she was a suicide case. She had jumped off of a bridge.
Okay, so we're seeing that at least some of these feet pair up and equal
yes.
a person.
Yes, exactly. So I think in likelihood we're dealing with six individuals, 12 feet, and we're, according to authorities, they say now it seems likely, that is their quote, that we are dealing with suicide victims and that all of these individuals are suicide cases.
Where are their feet going? Why are their feet?
Well, it's interesting that the feet aren't attached to the bodies. It's very interesting, though. And they're saying that there's credible evidence as to what's going on here. It says feet are the most likely part of the body to naturally detach once a body has been submerged underwater and submerged in strong currents. The feet could have floated to the surface because they were all in buoyant, lightweight, rubber-soled sneakers. So these feet were still found in sneakers. Heavier footwear would have sunk to the bottom, on the other hand. The British Columbia Coroner's Service has revealed that the woman, who has not yet been identified, but this is the suicide case, jumped from the Patullo Bridge in New Westminster, British Columbia, back in April 2004. Now, both of her feet, who police said were in New Balance running shoes, washed ashore 6 months apart in different parts of the Fraser River in Richmond, British Columbia, with the left found in May 2008 and the right foot in November of that same year. Now, according to ABC News, the Coroner's Service identified the woman through DNA analysis and a post-mortem investigation. The severed feet began washing ashore along the northwestern coast in 2007 in a case which baffled police and sparked a flurry of speculation as to how they got there. So who knows exactly what's going on? It's a very strange story. If there are more developments, of course, we will keep you in the loop here at the Grayling Report with regard to what might really be going on out there. That's a pretty bizarre story, but I'll tell you, there's one that might rival it. And this one has to do with, well, the legitimacy of the United States and our Declaration of Independence. In fact, I'm going to ask you right now, was it illegal for us to do so? That's what apparently was said this week in Philadelphia. American and British lawyers have debated the legality of America's founding documents. Apparently, last Tuesday night, while Republican candidates in Nevada were debating such American issues as nuclear waste disposal and the immigration status of Mitt Romney's gardener, and of course we were sitting here on the Grayling Report talking about weird stuff instead, American and British lawyers, in the meantime, were in Philadelphia, and they were taking on a far more fundamental topic. Just what did Thomas Jefferson think he was doing? Indeed, there's apparently an argument, and there are two sides, as there always are in any argument, but people are saying it looks like the Declaration of Independence, while a blow for freedom for some, namely Americans, well, it was also totally illegitimate and illegal. Now, joining us by phone is our foreign affairs field correspondent, Chris Hayes is in the studio with us right now. Chris McCollum, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
Fantastic. I'm sorry, I'll never call you a zombie again.
Please.
Yeah, I'll spare you. But now, Chris, you're joining us tonight. I thought that this would be a matter for a foreign affairs correspondent because this does have to do with, two sides of a fundamental story. Of course, there's the American attitude toward this, and this is not a joke, folks. As a matter of fact, we'll include this story, which was reported earlier this week by the BBC News. We'll include that in the show notes for tonight's program over at GraylingReport.com. On the other side of the pond, however, okay, there's this argument that the Declaration of Independence back in 1776 actually was completely illegal. So, Chris, what are we to make of this? Is this all hogwash, or is there actually a case to be made about the illegality of our Declaration of Independence as the United States of America?
completely illegal at that time. And if any of the people who are caught bearing witness to it or signing it or approving such a thing, if any of them were ever caught by the British, they all would have been hanged for treason.
It's an interesting circumstance.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It was simply an illegal act. We were British subjects in an established British land, and nothing granted by the Magna Carta or anything else ever gave anybody the explicit right to, quote-unquote, find these truths to be self-evident and to alter or abolish a form of government.
Do you think it was justified, though, as a means to
just... Absolutely. I think it was definitely justified. There's just no legal standing for it.
So, in other words, this is a good example of how, essentially, when tyrannical rule or any other kind of threat to your rights and liberties as an individual is imposed against you, there is sometimes a justifiable case for breaking the law.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. We've seen case after case of that, and rebellions and revolutions throughout the world ever since then. Most of them are using the United States as an example of being able to legally do so using the law of the land. However, the law of the land of the United States, while the Declaration of Independence was being penned and when it was signed, the law of the land was Britain's law, and Britain's law did not permit anything like that going on.
It's very interesting, and it's complex and amazing to me also. This was 1776, of course, when this, you know, when this debate first erupted. And here we are, centuries after the fact, and it is still a question that people are debating. Now, of course, you know, the folks on the U.S. side that met in Philadelphia a week ago, they, of course, were arguing that it was a necessity. I don't really see that there's much of an argument. I think instead there's a matter of, you know, historical... It's almost more philosophical debate, you know, in terms of the fact that, well, when is enough enough? And clearly, this isn't the only illustration. I think, and I share your belief that indeed there are times when the law not only should be broken, but must be broken in order to preserve justice. This is one of those...
I'm watching people pretend to do that right now, actually. It's amusing, to say the least.
Wait, hold on. You say you're watching people do that right now. Now, what are you talking about?
I'm watching them attempt to do so. I'm standing outside of an Occupy meeting, and or rally, I should say, and watching people have no idea what exactly it is that they're doing, and basically resorting to mob rule and calling it democracy, which I suppose is what mob rule is, if you really think about it.
You know, Chris, I admire that about you, because, you know, we have you on the program frequently, and there you are, right out there, as always, in the field, touching on things. It's you know, we're proud of you for the work you do.
Chris, are you in the tent village, or are they still at Pritchard Park?
No, they're... out here in front of the city building right now. I just came out of a city council meeting.
So you are in Asheville.
Chanting that this is what democracy looks like, when clearly this is not what democracy looks like. Because okay. What they're doing is having person shout and everybody else chant after them.
They do know we don't live in a democratic society, right? We live in a republic.
Don't give me any of that.
Well, no, okay, so I did want to make it clear, though. You are right now presently in Asheville, North Carolina, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I got you. So... What is your perception? I know that you've spent a little time at the Occupy movement. We had our New York field correspondent, Anya Briggs, on the program a couple of weeks ago, who gave us a fantastic field report from the New York Occupy situation. What's going on in Asheville right now?
Right now people are upset that they've been asked to leave from sleeping underneath one of the overpasses outside of downtown Asheville. So now they're gathering on the steps of City Hall and chanting that this is what democracy looks like, whatever it is exactly that's supposed to mean. Basically what it is people are just following along with somebody else is chanting something. And as usual with most of these movements, there's a lot of good ideas thrown in there, but at the same time, there's a lot of horrifying trains of thought as well. For example, I overheard a conversation between one person and another, and they're talking about what will remain of value after the value-based economy goes asunder and there's nothing left. And he was saying that the only things that will be worth anything would be seeds.
Well, you know,
because he's there's validity to that, of course. But he said that's going to be in place of gold, because the only people who are going to be left to value gold are going to be hanging from trees.
Oh, okay, I see. And it's going to be locked in the banks that get burned, right?
I suppose so. Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, I try to, as the listeners of this program know, I always try and walk the middle of the road, not just to appease people, but truly, I think that that's where true common sense lies. We have to be able to find middle ground on all these issues. We have to be able to respect one another. And I can see both sides. I've said, you know, that I support the Wall Street occupiers, but I also have supported the Tea Party. I see good and bad in both of those instances. And, you know, I will always stand for people's right to freedom of speech, expression, you know, any of the fundamental rights, not just those covered by the First Amendment, but, you know, there is, as always, with the Occupy movement, both good and bad. Now, what I told our field correspondent in New York, who we've got an update about a little later, you know, Anya contacted me, and she's been actually involved in some television recently. I don't want to say too much right now because I haven't asked her if we are allowed to talk about this, but I'll just tell you, our New York field correspondent hasn't been in New York lately, and she's been rather busy as well. But that said, when we had her on the program, she was in New York. She was actually reporting live from the occupation there near, you know, Wall Street. This is where the whole movement, you know, began, essentially. And she said that while there are a lot of people who are out there who don't, you know, they're younger people, they don't really know what they're there for, what their cause is, with any hope they will learn, and that there are libraries and there are people who are on hand, you know, hoping to try and fundamentally educate people. And if they need to learn anything, you know, putting politics and even to some degree history aside, I think that the economics of the situation is something that people fundamentally need to truly understand. And I think that, you know, if anything, if people don't have that knowledge when they enter the field, if they're out there in these tent camps or if they're out there, you know, poised outside banks and businesses and Wall Street and whatnot protesting, I hope that they will be not only activists, but they will also be in a process of learning more about, you know, what their purpose is in that capacity.
Yeah, of course. And what's the problem is, or the problem that's going on here, is that so many of the vocal majority of this group seem utterly insane, while so many others who seem afraid to voice their opinion, so to speak, are the more common sense minded individuals who are at the present being drowned out by those in the herd mentality, thinking that they have to break down the entire system in order to fix it, and they don't know exactly what it is they're breaking down or how they're going to fix it. So you have people who are willing to do irreparable damage and gain nothing from it, and that's the more frightening aspect about some of these movements. And as you're saying, I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with people's right to congregate, to form general assemblies, to petition for redress of grievances and everything else, and that's one of the reasons why I'm down here, is to observe constitutionally protected actions in action. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a lot of bad ideas circulating around that need to be tempered before this movement will cause anything closely resembling good results.
Excellent. Well, Chris, as always, thank you for joining us. You're a fantastic American. We hope you you know, stay safe, stay warm out there, and of course, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And as always, that is our foreign affairs and you know, national politics field correspondent, Chris McCollum, joining us there. We're going to have to turn him loose for the time being because we got to go pay the bills. I am Micah Hanks. When we come back, we will be discussing, well, there's going to be more strange news. You know what? I'll tell you what. Let's save that for when we come back. There's always more time on the other side, right? I am Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, and you've locked in for your Tuesday night dose of the strange and the unusual. It is the Grayling Report. I'm joined live in studio by producer Chris Hayes and the Reverend himself, Matt Oakley. We're all here, your ambassadors of the unexplained, keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And, well, we'll be back right after this break, so don't go anywhere.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
Of Appalachia. It's the Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Grayling Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grayling Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Special thanks to the epic utterances of the one and only John W. Anderson there. He's one of our fantastic voice talent here at the Grayling Report. You've locked in. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. keeps you company every Tuesday evening from 8 to 11 p.m. Again, next hour, I do want to mention that we'll be joined live here in the studio by another one of our fantastic field correspondents, none other than my brother, Caleb Hanks. He happens to be an expert on such matters as biological and technological singularity. We'll be talking about that a little bit and, well, basically what got Ray Kurzweil all pissed off this week. And let me tell you, he certainly did get rather perturbed. But more on that a bit later. We want to touch on something else briefly. There has been, get this, a UFO scene recently. And I know you're probably thinking, oh, come on, guy, really? I mean, we hear about UFOs all the time, especially on this program, every week for that matter. But no, this one, we had a celebrity guest who actually witnessed this UFO, okay? Matt Oakley here with the Grayling Report brings us more. Matt Oakley brings us more.
I'm going, man. You gotta. You just dropped it on me.
He had to crawl out of his shell first. I had to pull up the page. Matt Oakley brings us more, ladies and gentlemen.
I was trying to think of a great quip to come up, something about achy breaky heart, but no, I've just got that Billy Ray Cyrus on his Twitter feed, looks like yesterday, posted up that he has been doing a lot of photography, I guess, recently, and he has this post up here yesterday that says, "Okay, my first UFO sighting."
And he's serious now, isn't he?
He is dead serious. And what makes it even funnier is the actual photograph that he tweeted along with this. It looks like five or six disc shapes hovering. Special moment for Dad. Because he's not famous anymore, and he has to, like, ride on his daughter's fame these days.
That's right. And yeah. Didn't he and Miley do a television program of some sort together recently?
We don't usually keep,
you know, cable or HD or digital television, whatever they call it these days. We don't keep that on down here in the bunker very often. But, yeah, I know that I remember the guy who did that song back in the 1990s. I remember the cowboy boots, the terrible haircut, and now... Apparently he has witnessed what he calls an alien spaceship, or several of them, a fleet of them, if you will. Now we all saw the photograph here at the Grayling Report, and I have to say it is rather humorous. Chris, what are you seeing in that photograph? Which we will hopefully have linked to the website here momentarily.
Well, Micah, since you asked me,
Chris Hayes brings us more, ladies and gentlemen.
It's very clearly not six separate disc-shaped crafts. It's one nasty, globulous craft that six parts are poking through the clouds. It's very clear, if you look closely, they all connect into one big thing called the sky. It's the sun breaking through clouds. There are some cloud breaks, and it's the sun going through it.
Well, Billy Ray, I guess, you know, we appreciate, of course... you trying to photograph a UFO. Next time, maybe at least he'll get an airplane or something real, huh? But, you know, we don't want to be too hard on him. We want to leave that up to the listeners, you know, to berate and belittle Billy Ray Cyrus. So we'll try and get that link up here soon at graylianreport.com.
Well, yeah, if you berate him anymore, his achy breaky heart might just blow up and kill that man.
You know, somebody else unfortunately almost had a heart attack and died this week. It wasn't Billy Ray Cyrus. Did you guys?
But they heard one of his songs.
Yes. Unfortunately, there was an elderly woman.
The one radio transmission that actually reaches extraterrestrials is Achy Breaky Heart, and they decide we all have to die.
Yeah, yeah. That's what's going to start the alien apocalypse.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, that would be as good a scenario as any I could imagine. This actually did have to do with something extraterrestrial. This dealt with not an extraterrestrial being, but an extraterrestrial, what would you call it? I guess a moon rock, or maybe really more like a speck of moon dust. Yes, indeed, a NASA sting that the Associated Press reported on earlier this week resulted in a very terrified 74-year-old woman in Los Angeles. It was an elaborate mission, as described by the AP, to recover a moon rock led... now get this. I love this. It led NASA agents to one of the most down-to-earth places, a Denny's restaurant in Riverside County. So imagine we've got you folks. I wish you could see the snickering going on in the studio right now.
Well, I don't know how Denny's are, where they're from, but I know in my Denny's, when we sell moon rocks, we sell them for real.
Oh God! Yeah,
our complimentary moon rocks, cup of coffee with it, man.
Our moon rocks are green cheese and nothing else.
Well, yeah, and they probably glow in the dark and have mild traces of radioactivity and things like that. You're not talking about the kind that you order on your eggs when you go to Denny's, right?
Well, I do like moons over my hammy.
Moons over your hammy. Well,
no, these are the ones order on the eBay.
Sometimes you can get into some pretty good price bidding wars on the eBay.
That's right. I'm surprised somebody didn't try it. Well, you know, see, that's the big thing, basically. What this boils down to is that NASA's really cracking down on people who are presently trying to sell NASA memorabilia online, okay? And that means anything that has basically been recovered from space or, you know, that has been a part of a space mission. You remember we reported on this earlier this week, Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell.
I believe, the fifth man to walk on the moon. Well, Dr. Edgar Mitchell got the smackdown put on him by NASA because he had a camera that had been used in one of the moon landings. I presume that Dr. Mitchell may have even operated this camera during that mission. And when he tried to sell it on eBay as a piece of history, to a high bidder who wanted to collect, you know, a piece of space exploration history and whatnot, well, NASA went after him for doing that. Well, it's the same sort of thing here. And there is a tie-in with an astronaut here. Get this. Okay, so anyway, there was this, what was described as an elaborate mission. It led them to a down-to-earth Denny's restaurant in Riverside County near Los Angeles. But at the end of the sting operation, agents were left holding a speck of lunar dust smaller than a grain of rice and a 74-year-old suspect who was terrified by officials. And folks, they were armed. I mean, we had people there with weapons, presumably drawn, ready to take this person into custody if necessary. Now, I'm sure NASA officials couldn't do that, but I'm assuming that there were arresting officers, you know, and assisting, you know, law enforcement assisting with this raid to recover this moon rock. 5 months after NASA investigators and local agents swooped into the restaurant and hailed their operation as a cautionary tale for anyone trying to sell national treasure, no charges ended up being filed. NASA isn't talking, and get this, the case now apparently appears to be stalled. The target, Joanne Davis, a grandmother who says she was trying to raise money for her sick son, asserts that the lunar material was rightfully hers, having been given to her, get this, her space engineer husband, okay, by Neil Armstrong in the 1970s. So her husband apparently had been a space engineer, and he had actually been given this piece of rock by Neil Armstrong, the astronaut. It's a very upsetting thing, Davis told the Associated Press. It's very detrimental, very humiliating, and all of it a lie. The strange case centers on a speck of authenticated moon rock encased in an acrylic-looking dome that appears to be a paperweight. For years, NASA has gone after anyone selling lunar material gathered on the Apollo missions because it is considered government property and so cannot be sold, technically, for profit. But still, NASA has given hundreds of lunar samples to nations and states and high-profile individuals, only on the understanding, however, that they remain government property. So in other words, they can give you a piece of history. They can give you a piece of our lunar satellite, but you can't sell it because even if you have it in your possession, you can be awarded or given one as a gift, but it remains government property and you're not supposed to sell them. The case was triggered by Davis herself, according to a search warrant affidavit written by Norman Conley, who was an agent for the Inspector General. She emailed a NASA contractor on May 10th trying to find a buyer for the rock, as well as a nickel-sized piece of the heat shield that protected the Apollo 11 space capsule as it returned to Earth from the first successful manned mission to the moon in 1969. How about that? She said, "I've been searching the internet for months attempting to find a buyer," Davis wrote. "If you have any thoughts as to how I can proceed with the sale of these two items, please call me." Davis told AP that the items were among many of the space-related heirlooms her husband left her when he died in 1986. She said she had worked as a lexicographer, and he had worked as an engineer for North American Rockwell, which contracted for NASA during the Apollo era. Davis claims Armstrong gave the items to her husband, though the affidavit says that the first man on the moon has previously told investigators that he never gave or sold lunar material to anyone. So in follow-up conversations with a NASA agent, Davis acknowledged that the rock was not sellable on the open market and fretted about an agent knocking on her door and taking the material, which she was willing to sell for big money underground. Sounds to me like she knew what she was doing. She must know that this is a questionable transaction because she used the term quote-unquote black market, Agent Connolly states in the search warrant. Curiously, though, now get this, Davis agreed to sell the sample to NASA for a stellar $1.7 million. That'd be enough to build a lunar base, well, at least in 1967, if your name's Dr. Evil. She said she wanted to leave her three children an inheritance and take care of her sick son. NASA investigators then arranged the sting where Connolly met with Davis and her current husband at the Denny's at Lake Elsinore in Riverside County. Soon after settling into a booth, Davis said she pulled out the moon sample and about a half a dozen sheriff's deputies and NASA investigators rushed into the eatery. Imagine the scene. We've got an elderly old lady and her husband, and she pulls out a little piece of sand encased in acrylic, and then all these agents swarm in with their weapons drawn. When officers in flak vests took a hold of her, the 4'11" woman said that she was so scared she lost control of her bladder. Oh, guys, come on. Leave it up to a couple of ne'er-do-wells like you to laugh at this poor old gal for peeing all over herself. She said she lost control of her bladder and was taken outside to a parking lot where she was questioned and detained for about 2 hours.
Now she had to pee herself, man. If she didn't, the terrorists would have won.
Well,
the terrorists win.
I'm sorry, Micah. Your delivery was a little implicit in our laughter. Like,
I'm a newsman. Okay, I'm
like,
a
if you guys are going to laugh every time you hear about some elderly lady peeing herself in public, then
I'm a newsman. It's just the facts, okay?
Okay. It's that pregnant pause before you said lost control of her bladder that really
I'm about to give you guys a 3-2-1 hush mouth. You know. Okay, anyway, point is, she says that they grabbed her, they pulled her out of the booth, and that she even had deep bruises on her left side. Now, I do ask this. Was it really that necessary? They obviously knew who they were arresting because, I'm sorry, she was 4'11", and they grabbed her and pulled her out of the booth. They obviously knew who they had. Was it really necessary to scare the woman that badly?
Even to use that much force?
Did they believe that she was armed and dangerous?
Like, I just got to think. Here's the little old lady, man. She's got some, you know.
She's packing heat, probably.
God knows what she's got under that blouse. She's got a moon rock at Denny's. She's having a cup of coffee and a moon's over Miami. And God only knows what could happen.
Yeah, like I said, you know, she could be armed and dangerous, obviously, you know. Granny's packing pistols here. No, she didn't sound like she was very dangerous. I haven't seen a photograph, but again, they described her as 4'11". It seems a little ridiculous that she'd be treated this way. So Agent Connolly declined to comment, and NASA Office of the Inspector General spokeswoman Renee Ujhan said that she could not talk about an ongoing investigation. So apparently the facts that we're giving you right now, as reported by the AP, are all that is known at present. But Davis was eventually allowed to go home. She was released, apparently, from custody. She wasn't allowed to leave with the moon rock, granted, and apparently was never booked into a police station or charged. The affidavit states that authorities believe Davis was in possession of stolen government property, but so far they've not publicly revealed any proof of this. So I don't know. What are your thoughts? Do you think that she was mistreated? Was it an unfair act that was imposed against Mrs. Davis for possession of this moon rock? Was excessive force used? Or was it coming to her? Did she deserve that? Especially for advertising on the internet that, well, she was looking to sell this thing on the black market. Did she bring this on herself, or, well, was she really kind of treated unfairly for something that maybe she thought was rightfully hers? If you'd like to join the program, you can join us by phone at 828-398-4886. And, of course, Skype users, as always, can reach us through Skype at Skype handle Graylien Report. That's Graylien Report on Skype. Easy enough to find us. So if anyone does want to share their thoughts, we'll if we've got time this hour, we'll try and get at least one or two calls in there.
I think that this whole thing really shows us that all the federal government is a bunch of Indian givers.
How's that, Matt?
You know, the Christmas present thing where you give someone something and I want that.
See, here's the thing. This is where it gets a little tricky, though.
You can have it until I need it.
Now, the government has acknowledged, NASA, rather, has acknowledged that there have been instances where they have actually given people samples of, you know, moon dust and other things like that. In this instance, however, there was no official admission that she was ever given this. And even Neil Armstrong, the astronaut, whom she claimed had given it to her husband years and years ago. Even Neil Armstrong apparently has you know, said under legal circumstances, I believe they'd said that he had signed an affidavit that said that he had never given or sold anything to anyone. So, you know, there is a little bit, I think, of question as to exactly where this piece of moon dust came from. And if there's enough question about that right now, that's probably the very same reason that, you know, investigators aren't talking about this a whole lot. There's still a lot of questions that need to be answered. You know, I don't know, Chris, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, all laughter aside, the way the elderly lady was treated is beyond reproach, or not beyond reproach, is incredibly reproachful. But it's really not that surprising. I mean, as far as NASA investigators being involved, yeah, but, you know, a dozen law enforcement agents on one small elderly person isn't really that out of the ordinary. Like, there was a news story, I believe, out of Texas where during the whole, when the, what is it, the airline scanners were new, when people would go through and
TSA officials
up in arms about getting, you know, naked x-rays to get on a plane. Well, they apparently, you know, had to, or didn't have to, but searched a young child, like a 6-year-old girl,
I
something
saw that.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that is clearly unnecessary.
What was the child hiding, you know? And furthermore, you know, how many little children have you seen, you know, with the exception of maybe, you know, the obvious bulge that a diaper is going to cause, okay, when the child is wearing a diaper, how many children have you seen that, you know, had big, baggy, loose clothing that could have been concealing weapons or bombs or things like that? You know, I mean, indeed, there are points beyond which, you know, it gets to be, you know, a little too much. And I don't have the story available to me right now. Maybe one of you guys can find this. There was a story from earlier this week talking about surprise TSA checkpoints in the state of Tennessee. Anybody heard anything about this? This was a news story that I saw this past week. I think Matt's going to try and find that for us. But the story was essentially this, that in Tennessee, they were doing random. The Transportation Security Administration had been doing random screenings of some sort. Now, again, I don't want to say too much because I don't have the story here. I don't want to, you know, put out misleading facts, but there were indeed headlines about that. Maybe when we come back from this break, we can touch on that a little bit here, because I certainly think that, you know, when it, and this kind of comes back to what we were talking about with Chris McCollum during the first segment this hour, and, you know, we have fundamental rights, okay, as citizens, and some of those rights, you know, protect us from unfair treatment and punishment of different, you know, varieties, cruel and unusual punishments, speaking of, and also self-incrimination. So, you know, these things have to be taken care of, and also, you know, the more fundamental privileges like freedom of speech, you know, something that we exercise a good bit right here on this program. And, of course, we always offer the floor to you, too, when the phone lines are open, which they are right now. If you'd like to chime in on this matter, you know how to reach us, and you can visit www.graylianreport.com for more info on that. When we come back, we'll continue this and other strange news from beyond the fringe. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back right after this.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology? The best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
cruising along to the sounds of Rat Jackson, some good friends of ours here on the Graylian Port. Of course, you know who we are. I'm your friendly neighborhood Graylian, the mouth of the South himself, Micah Hanks. Welcome back to the program. Last segment, we were talking about this weirdness going on. And again, you know, in a sense, we know it's justified. This poor gal, Mrs. Davis, who was in her 70s, as I understand, did indeed advertise that she was trying to essentially sell a piece of the moon on the black market and try and find an under-the-table buyer. And NASA swooped in and, well, nailed her for it. But was she mistreated? That's the question right now. And if you want to join us by phone, 828-398-4886, you can also email us info@graylianreport.com if you'd like to send along information that way. But there's something else that I want to move on to briefly while we do have a little time this hour. There was another story, and I touched on this before the commercial break. It had to do with a TSA operation ongoing, if I remember correctly, in the state of Tennessee. And this had to do with random, well, checkpoints, if I understand the information. Matt, can you give us information about this, please?
Yeah, sure. It appears that the Tennessee Department of Safety and Homeland Security and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Transportation Security Administration, and several other state and federal agencies have started a safety enforcement and awareness operation on Tennessee's, get this, interstates. Not like, that's pretty out there to me.
They're actually stopping people on interstates?
Yeah, apparently. Okay. And so it's on the Tennessee interstates and two metropolitan area bus stations, and they're randomly inspecting vehicles on highways in Tennessee.
Now, this is the TSA. Mm-hmm. That's actually doing this. Now,
yeah, are the Department of Homeland Security.
Okay, I guess they actually have jurisdiction to do that. See, as I understand, Transportation Security Administration officials, you know, although they're stationed in airports, it was always my understanding that this was something that airports could initially at least opt in or out of. In other words, they didn't have to have this as long as they could provide other, you know, security measures. Now, you know, this whole situation has gotten very murky. A lot of the liberty and freedom advocates have, you know, really, really, really been outspoken about this. I have, too. And I'll tell you primarily what really began to bother me about this this whole situation about this time last year. In fact, I went on my buddy Landland Fears' program, Overnight AM, and talked about this as a fill-in host one evening, because what was essentially going on was that some of these full-body scanners, you remember hearing about the full-body scanners, many of which are still in use in airports around the country right now. Well, these full-body scanners are able to render images that essentially show you standing there, you know, sans clothing, all natural, in the nude, buck naked, if you know what I mean. And we're told, or at least we were told initially, that these things were not going to be able to store the images that were taken of people like you and I. And then, guess what happens? It appears that there was indeed a machine in the District of Columbia, and then another one, I think, in a courthouse somewhere in Florida, which had been storing the images and which, of course, somehow were retrieved from one of the machines. And then these images, now you couldn't tell who the people were. So nobody's, you know, there weren't nudie pics going up of people all over the place that really were entirely recognizable. But the point is that we were always told these images should not be accessible and will not be saved on these machines. And what the hell happens anyway? The images are stored on the machine, they're downloaded, and then hundreds of them, literally hundreds of them, appear on the internet, online. And indeed, there were all these naked pictures from people who had gone through these full-body scanners. So what they were telling us was that, oh, no, 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 you are absolutely safe. There is no chance, you know, of your rights being, you know, infringed upon. You're not in any kind of danger here. And, you know, you don't need to worry about this. This is entirely safe. You know, you're not only are you not going to be shown, pictures of you aren't going to be shown to anyone, but also, as we understand it, these things are also safe to use. Now, that's a whole entirely different question in terms of what, you know, harmful levels of radiation and the like could be, you know, what people may be exposed to. But before we get to that, we'll go to the phones. Leslie now joins us live from Tennessee. You're in that great state where this is all going on. How are you tonight, Leslie?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
Doing fantastic. What's on your mind tonight?
Actually, a couple years ago, I ran off the road and hit like a church gate. It was kind of like one of those big farm gates. It's really hard to explain. I didn't do much damage. I actually only did about $60 worth of damage. And somebody was at the church and came out, and we worked it out. But while we were working it out, a random truck pulled into the church's parking lot, and a guy got out, and he like flashed his Homeland Security badge and wouldn't let me leave.
Really?
Yeah, even though it was private property. And the guy from the church kept saying, "This is private property. We've worked this out. She can go." And he really did not want to let me leave. And talking about the Tennessee State, I don't know. The Tennessee Highway being patrolled by the TSA reminded me of that story. Yeah, they actually didn't want to let me leave, even though it was private property, and the owner of the church wanted to let me go.
Well, that's really interesting. So now the actual – now you say the owner of the property, which was essentially – not okay, I'm sorry. The owner of the church was not let me see. How do we want to say this? This person at least was able to act within the capacity of being able to represent that the ownership of that property. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. Yeah, he was the owner of the property and the church and everything.
Okay, and this individual said it would be okay for you to go free and clear, and yet there was this official who was there on hand saying that they wanted to detain you. Now, what exactly was his purpose for wanting to detain you?
He didn't say. He only flashed his badge and said that I needed to wait until police got there. He was plain clothes. He was not in any sort of uniform. He was in just like a regular car, unmarked vehicle, and the owner of the land and the property and the church pulled him aside and said, "This is completely unnecessary. You know, she needs to go. This is private property." And they let me go, but he didn't want to. He did want to keep me there until, I guess, police got there. I'm not sure what they would have done. But, yeah, he wanted to keep me there.
That's interesting. You know, I hate to say this, Leslie, but, you know, it sounds a lot to me like somebody has a little bit too much time on their hands and they were looking for something to do.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me as well. But I just wanted to call in and relay that story because that's what that kind of reminded me of.
Well, thank you very much. It's always good to hear from you, Les. And, well, you know, I'll tell you what, just try not to hit any more fences. I'm sure you'll be safer in general.
Thank you.
All right, have a great evening. Thanks. You know, that is strange, though, you know, I mean, and of course, granted, the name, I guess, maybe doesn't say it all, but it says it for the most part, at least, transportation, not airplane security. In other words, they are, you know, they're maintaining or supposed to be helping maintain safety in airports, but there are obviously other areas of transportation where this extends to as well. And in Tennessee, they're seeing a lot of this right now, apparently.
And it's actually funny, I was reading a little bit more while Leslie was talking. Apparently, this is not a surprise thing, this TSA patrolling the highways and doing random searches on cars. Apparently, in Tampa, Florida, bus stations have long been occupied by TSA checkpoints enforcing random searches. Hmm.
Well,
for a
see,
long time, apparently.
What?
And you don't hear about this.
Sure. And I guess this criteria isn't detailed, I'm sure, here. But I wonder what constitutes, you know, what is it? I don't know if you'd call it probable cause for a random search. What is it that causes, you know, a necessity for random searches? In other words, what methods are they? What are they screening for when it comes to these random searches? Are they literally just stopping people at random? You know, every third or fourth person, or are there certain things they're looking for?
I think they're randomly having the searches. Like, they're not searching random cars as they go, but randomly one day they're like, "Hey, let's do a search." You
kind
know,
of like
they,
a roadblock, you know, that, like the police would do, like a license
yeah,
check or something.
Like if they were screening or looking for something in particular, then that would negate the randomness of the search.
See,
I think they're just, you know, doing it to do it to, you know, show presence. I mean, it's a little weird because you traditionally associate the TSA people with airports, but
sure.
Like Matt said, in the bus stations, that I can understand, like bus stations, Amtrak stations, things like that, anywhere where you're going to check baggage. Mm-hmm. I can understand their presence.
And in some capacities, you know, I don't mind that. I mean, really, I think, see, this is where it gets difficult.
But where does it stop?
Well, exactly. That's where it is. There is a gray area. You know, how much are we willing to give up of our natural freedoms, okay, in order to enforce our safety? And that's the thing. I don't like the idea of getting on an airplane and someone screaming, "Allahu Akbar, you're all going to die," like what happened last week, you know, while I'm flying on an airplane. That kind of thing is terrifying. And, you know, I want to be able to know that if I'm going to fly someplace or if I'm going to be driving or riding on a bus or a train, you know, or anything else. Hell, if I'm transporting myself with an Acme portable hole, I want to know that it's going to be, you know, achieved safely. But the thing is that what worries me is when we give enough of our freedoms up, and there's this take mentality to the point that literally you're being strip searched before you can get on an airplane. Your children are being strip searched. They're what amount to, you know, nude photographs being taken of you. And your body could be exposed to harmful radiation, something that's not going to bother someone like, you know, Chris, the holy half-dead, you know, zombified producer here. But, you know, for someone like Matt or I, you know, if we got to go through an airport screening, you know, and we're flying frequently to go to conferences and, you know, meetings and events and things like that, you know, is there a harmful level of radiation that people are being exposed to? Are there studies that actually talk about this and that deal with this subject, you know, in a legitimate and thorough way? At this point, you know, I mean, I haven't seen that data. We've been told that, oh, no, there's not anything to worry about. There aren't any dangers associated with these things. But we were also told initially that people's photographs wouldn't be stored on those and that your privacy will be maintained to the fullest. And, well, what ended up happening regardless? The same thing that always happens. We were told a bunch of lies, and those photographs were downloaded, and now there's nudie pics of people all over the web who walk through these things in two different locations in the United States. That's the part that I don't agree with. But anyway, I can talk about it until I'm blue in the face. We're already green. We're the Graylian Gang. Your favorites on Tuesday nights. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this discussing Singularity with Caleb Hanks.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome back to the program. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. I'm your ever-loving host, the Map of the South himself, Mr. Micah Hanks, and you've locked in to your weekly favorite, your favorite gang of Graylians, broadcasting live from hundreds of miles, literally hundreds of miles below the Earth's surface, here in the Graylian Bunker. Joining me, as always, is our producer, of course, Mr. Chris Hayes, and our engineer, the Reverend back there, Mr. Reverend Matt Oakley. Always good to have you guys in the studio with me. Well, we were getting all worked up last hour. That seems to be what we do on a weekly basis. We get worked up about something. You never really know which direction this kind of program is going to go. But last week, we weren't worked up about, you know, people's liberties being infringed upon and the like. No. We were worrying about other things. We were talking about singularity, in fact. And we're going to talk about that a little bit tonight as well, because there was a situation that went on recently that involved Ray Kurzweil, who is, of course, you know, one of the big transhumanist advocates of a technological singularity in mankind's future. To be specific, he actually guesses that this converging point between rapid expansion of technology and information systems and digitization of information systems and even, you know, the furtherance of artificial intelligence and the World Wide Web, many things that are present here on Earth today as they continue to grow and expand. Well, Kurzweil says that things are going to get to a point where not only will technology be increasing faster than exponentially, and at such a surprising and alarming rate, but that we're also going to begin to see this kind of merging between humans and technology. This what they call a singularity event. It's an interesting idea, either way you want to look at it. I think it's unsettling in a lot of ways for some people. I think it's also something that a lot of people, you know, are kind of looking forward to, because literally what they're talking about in terms of singularity is, you know, not only ability to utilize artificial intelligence and even the opposite, okay, which would be intelligent artificial life, human-based, okay, cybernetics and things like that to enhance ourselves, but we could also back up our knowledge, human knowledge, you know, what's stored in the brain, the capacity of the mind, backed up into digital format, so that essentially humans could be, well, recreated, sort of, okay? But not everybody seems to dig this idea or even think that it's a likelihood. For instance, a guest contributor at Technology Review, which is published by MIT University, last week talked about, well, why he thought the singularity isn't very near. He says futurists like Werner Vinge and Ray Kurzweil have argued that the world is rapidly approaching a tipping point where the accelerating pace of smarter and smarter machines will soon outrun all human capabilities. They call this tipping point the singularity because they believe it is impossible to predict how the human future might unfold after this point. Now, once these machines exist, Kurzweil and Vinge claim they'll possess a superhuman intelligence that is so incomprehensible to us that we cannot even rationally guess how our life experiences would be altered. Vinge, who's a science fiction writer and mathematician, asks us to ponder the role of humans in a world where machines are as much smarter than us as we are smarter than our pet dogs and cats. Kurzweil, who's a bit more optimistic, envisions a future in which developments in medical nanotechnology will allow us to download a copy of our individual brains. This is what I was talking about a moment ago, backing our knowledge base up. He says it will allow us to download a copy of our individual brains into these superhuman machines, leave our bodies behind, and in a sense live forever. It's pretty heady stuff. But he doesn't really buy it. In fact, Paul Allen, the guest contributor who wrote this, referenced an article that Kurzweil wrote, if I understand correctly, about 10 years ago called The Law of Accelerating Returns. It's published at Kurzweil's website. And he basically breaks a lot of this apart and says that, well, essentially Kurzweil and Vinge and others who are proponents of this coming singularity, what they're proposing, it might not be impossible, but it is definitely a little far-fetched and unlikely. Kurzweil, on the other hand, responded. He issued a rebuttal this week, and he says that, last week, Paul Allen and a colleague challenged the prediction that computers will soon exceed human intelligence. And so he goes after him. Kurzweil says, with my 1999 book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, and then, of course, the augmented version that came out later in an essay he wrote, this was, of course, this Law of Accelerating Returns, he said he did indeed, this is Kurzweil talking, he says they did indeed generate several lines of criticism, and many people would say that, that he was wrong about a lot of these points. And even Kurzweil says that while he stands by those arguments, that he wrote this latest book, The Singularity Is Near, to respond directly to those critiques of the earlier work. He says, I cannot say that Allen would necessarily be convinced by the arguments I made in the book, but at least he could have responded to what I actually wrote. Instead, he offered de novo arguments as if nothing had ever been written to respond to those issues. Allen's descriptions of my own positions appear to be drawn from my 10-year-old essay, and while I continue to stand by that essay, Allen does not summarize my positions correctly, even from that essay. Now, while Kurzweil goes on to touch on exactly what Paul Allen did and did not say and why he felt that it was unjust what was being said, I could go into all that right now. But frankly, joining us now by phone is one of our field correspondents, our futurist division of the Grillion International, Mr. Caleb Hanks, my younger brother, and he happens to be an expert on singularity, Ray Kurzweil, and transhumanism. Caleb, how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing fantastic. There's that accent again. I thought I was talking to Dr. Manhattan. No, I'm kidding, actually.
It always comes out on the radio. Hey, and I must clarify, you've called me an expert on singularity, and I must clarify that I am completely far from that, but only merely interested.
Well, we're glad to have you on the program either way, because I do consider you to be someone who's quite in the know with this. You follow, science, technology, also performance art and music. And I should also say that, for those who are listening to the program, we get a lot of compliments on the music on this program. And today, During the coming back from the very first segment during hour one, we featured a very interesting piece of music, which we of course used as comeback music, and John Anderson's voice was heard giving the phone numbers out and everything. But that piece of music, I'll go ahead and tell folks, was actually something that was written and composed by none other than Caleb Hanks, who joins us now by phone. It's fantastic stuff, and I appreciate you submitting that here to the Graylian Report. You know, we feature a lot of your band's music, the Nova Echo, here on the program, which also sort of deals with futuristic themes. But that said, getting to the situation with Kurzweil, do you think that it is unfounded that people like Paul Allen criticize Kurzweil and say that what he is proposing is far-fetched? I mean, let's be honest, it does sound pretty far-fetched what Kurzweil talks about, you know, about the singularity event and humans merging with machines and backing up our brains and supercomputers and things. Is there really a case to be made for this, and do you think it's going to happen when Kurzweil says it will?
Well, I'll start out by saying, I don't think it's strange at all for somebody to question a lot of this stuff, because when Kurzweil was first brought to my attention, it was through a movie called Transcendent Man, which is a Netflix documentary about Ray and his life's work. And when I first saw the film, I thought, wow, that's some really interesting stuff, but I wasn't necessarily sold on it. And strangely enough, a few days later, I was brought via the website StumbleUpon his Law of Accelerating Returns essay, and I immediately started reading it, and after a while, I finally finished it, and I thought, wow, you know, I'm not the most mathematically minded person, but, you know, from what I can tell with these graphs and whatnot, that when you look at things growing on an exponential scale rather than an intuitive linear scale, as so he shows in that essay big time, it really starts to make sense. And if you look at it, and I use this example all the time, I don't think it's really too terribly far-fetched to look at just the implications of how technology has been growing and how, you know, 10,000 years we had horse, wheel, buggy, fire, that sort of thing, but then within the past 100 years we have such events like the Industrial Revolution, and then we have this huge technological boom. 10 years ago our cell phones were glorified calculators, and now they have touchscreen capability, voice recognition capability, all these incredible things that we never would have, you know, ever thought we would have had 20 years ago.
Things have been speeding up, haven't they?
They have, and it's strange because, it does seem that these things are just growing at an extremely rapid rate, and honestly, you can see that happening in everyday life, and, you know, I don't think that his projections, you know, they could be off by a few years, even a decade, but even so, that's, you know, not much of a hiccup in the whole projection either way. I've been reading the book The Singularity Is Near, and as far as the article goes by Mr. Allen and Mr. Greaves, you know, I don't feel like they're just, you know, bashing him. I can totally see how somebody who hasn't seen, you know, any of the graphs or any of these things or heard the way that Kurzweil explains how these processes are happening exponentially, I can see why it would be hard for anybody to really grasp it, to just be like, oh, you know, we're going to be computers in the next 50 years.
Now, is that exactly what Kurzweil's saying? Is he actually saying that we will become computers?
I guess you could say that in a sense. Mainly what the idea would be, and, you know, if I was trying to explain the idea of singularity to a 10-year-old, I know that this is probably a rough version of what I would say, but basically I would give the analogy that the things that comprise your body are particles, and the same number or the same particles that are in your body 2 weeks from now are not going to be the same particles in your body that are in your body now. And as we look at how the microization of microchips is, you know, they're just getting smaller and smaller, and the rate that they're getting smaller and smaller is growing faster and faster, that Kurzweil predicts that at some point in the future there'll be nanotechnologies, which are blood cell-sized computers that we either have injected or ingested into our bodies, that would be able to go in, scan our brains from the inside out, be able to basically record, just like a computer file, all of our mind files, our memories, so to speak, And basically with that, and they have this technology already with Parkinson's patients, they have pea-sized nanocomputers that they put into their brains that actually release pathogens and download and update software that are, you know, in their brains. And nine times out of ten, these people that are asked, like, do you feel like this computer is part of you, or it's just this, you know, external device, they say, no, this computer is part of me. And so the idea is basically that once we're able to take in pathogens and download information with blood cell size nanotechnology in our bodies, that after a while, they would be able to reprogram our biology, reverse the aging process, and inevitably, eventually, turn us into what would be a swarm of nanotechnology. But it wouldn't be so drastic as a change of I'm biological this moment, I am a robot the next. It would be somewhat of a very gradual change, and your mind and everything like that would still stay in place. Just kind of a thing to where it's technological evolution is moving faster than biological evolution. Although biological evolution is still moving, technological evolution is just kind of going faster, and it's the next step in the spectrum, supposedly.
In a sense, describing it like you do there, as opposed to singularity, you know, a coming together of biology and technology, transference almost might be a better term in the sense that...
Well, at that stage, but then it gets a little bit more in-depth when you get into the ideas of AI and how human/technological homo mechanicus, if you will, would react with artificial intelligence, and that opens up a whole new can of worms. And if you'd like to talk about that too, I'd be more than happy. But either way, you know, just the whole transition into a more technological than biological, you know, that's the basic idea of it all.
Well, trying to understand in completion, and first let me just say that, you know, that's a very nice analogy that you gave us. That if anything, you know, I remember in grade school myself being told, you know, by teachers, you know, what's funny about, you know, the lifespan of cells and cell division and replication and all this is that, you know, the person you are right now, you will not be that same person. You will be an entirely different living being 7 years from now. Once, you know, every cell in your body has, you know, has divided and whatnot and everything, and some have died, and new ones are, I don't know if you want to say born, but, you know, mitosis and the like, and all these, you know, natural biological processes occur, and then you literally, years on down the road, are a physically different person from the person that you once were. It's very interesting, and what you described is very similar to that.
So basically what you're saying is we're all like the rivers that Pocahontas sang about?
Exactly. We are the rivers that Pocahontas sang about.
Caleb, didn't I actually hear somebody use a analogy similar to that, though, like, you know, about water in a river flowing by?
Yeah. It's kind of the idea that the body, the human body, is the river. And the river, you know, even though it stays that same formation that it is, though it may change a little bit here and there over time, it's still that basic formation of the river. And if you look at it that kind of analogy, we're kind of the same thing, because that form, the person, the body, the consciousness, that is all there. But biologically or technologically, what we could be or are comprised of is kind of, I don't know, irrelevant, I guess you could say.
That's another good analogy.
Some people would say that. That's irrelevant is definitely not the word to use, but
I think. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm sure the listeners do also. And actually, that's a very good analogy as well. You know, that the river remains, it's always water in the same place, but the molecules, the actual physical makeup of that river changes and washes downstream. You know, all things change, and in that sense, the transference or the, you know, the migration, you know, whatever you want to call it, from biological to maybe partially cybernetic, and then eventually maybe something entirely different from what we are. Again, to borrow, you know, something our guest last week, Maxim Kammerer, Dr. Kammerer, did refer to homo mechanicus, and I caught that reference that you made. So indeed, you know, maybe that progression to that eventual state, which although it is unlike what we are now, maybe that will actually, you know, be, in a sense, very natural.
Honestly, another thing too is like, if you look at it as to where over time, evolution, you know, gave us the opposable thumb and the intelligence to make tools and sort of things like that. It's really honestly just what becomes the human quest for knowledge and furthering ourselves and advancing whether it be something we're conscious of evolutionarily or not.
You know, I would probably argue this, that if while some would find it fantastic, you know, from the, you know, let's go back to colonial times, people, 1776, American Revolution, if they were brought immediately from our past into this presence, or present day, that we're, you know, operating in right now, the present time as we perceive it, and they saw all the automobiles and the airplanes, and they saw the mass media and the, you know, the market culture that we have, the computers all over the place.
They'd be absolutely terrified.
They would be terrified, and there would be some people who would say, wow, look at the pretty colors, and they'd want to stay, and then there would be some that would say, get me the hell out of here. Hey, speaking of getting the hell out of here, actually, we're up on a break. Caleb, can you actually stay with us through the break and so that we could talk about this just a little bit more? I did have a couple more questions if you've got time.
Yeah, I got all time in the world.
Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to keep you on hold during the break, and when we come back, we're going to ask Caleb what the next step is. If indeed, you know, maybe this sort of transference, this transmogrification from this human state into some, well, something else, if that's just one phase, what comes next? I'd be interested in hearing, and we're going to have Caleb Hanks, my brother, quite the intellectual. And indeed, I would consider him quite the expert on the transhumanist ideals. He's going to stick around with us here on the Greylian Report and talk about this. So we'll see indeed if Ray Kurzweil's statements are defensible and if he was in the right this week. I'm Micah Hankson. It is the Greylian Report. We'll be back right after this.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havokin.
This is Alice Cooper for RADD. There's a lot of things we have no control of in this world, but that's not the case with drunk driving. If you're going to drink, don't drive. Think ahead and choose a designated driver. Remember, music lives on and so should you.
Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, it's the Greylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Greylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Greylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Thank you, John Anderson, and also want to thank Caleb Hanks, who is our guest right now. He was the composer of that music that you're now listening to. Caleb, I have to say, that's some fantastic music.
Hey, thank you very much. And a strange little side note, I actually got that done between the hours of 6 p.m. last night and this afternoon, so it's very, very fresh.
Well, it is certainly very fresh, and I thank you so much for bringing that to our audience here at the Greylian Report and allowing them to be the very first to hear this. It's going to probably remain regular, you know, comeback music here on this program, and of course there'll be certainly plenty more where that comes from. You're going to be going out on the road here soon, of course, with the Nova Echo. I hope that's not sensitive information. Is it okay that we say that? I just did.
Oh no, we've announced it on the internet. I'm pretty sure we're going to be doing a Northeast tour from November something to November something, but it's going to be a decent amount of time, so it should be fun.
You know, it's funny because, you know, you and I are both very similar. Well, first of all, I mean, we're brothers, and I guess according, I don't really think so. You probably agree with me, but a lot of people think we look kind of alike. But the other, but the other thing about that, it maybe, I don't know, maybe in a post-singularity world, we'll look a lot more alike. Maybe we'll look like, you know, Autobots or something. I don't know. But what I find, what I find funny is that, you know, we both kind of, you know, we do, there's a duality, I guess, to our existence. You know, I perform as a musician several nights a week with you. We play bluegrass together, you know, in a couple of different groups, and we make a good portion of our living playing music, the Hanks Brothers. In addition to that, though, you know, I've got this weird stuff I do, and of course, you know, I host the Graylian Report, and you, whether or not you accept the role yourself, I'm going to tell you, I consider you quite the authority on, you know, transhumanism and all this, and, you know, our mutual interest in characters like Kurzweil and you know, Alexei Turchin, who I've been going back and forth with a lot recently. He's a Russian transhumanist with some really interesting ideas. His English is you know, a bit limited, but he's brilliant. And at some point, I would really, really, really love to get him on the Graylian Report if I can. And then, of course, Dr. Maxim Kammerer, who joined us last week, and even, you know, Mac Tonies, our tribute from, you know, well beyond the grave. Who knows, you know, if indeed intelligence can be backed up and people can be replicated in the future, maybe we can get, you know, some aspect of Mac and his intellect back in the future. But that's a real problem for a lot of people. It has moral and ethical implications. And so I wanted to start by asking a question that Red Pill Junkie, our friend from the Daily Grail website, he is in the chat room with us right now, and he actually asked what our father, who is an Episcopal priest, would think about the singularity. I was actually
reading along in the chat room, and I wanted to address that question myself after seeing that, because you know, that was a really fun time for me. I was talking with my dad about singularity, and you know, to be perfectly honest, I wasn't quite expecting his answer, because you know, you get into this territory where you're talking about backing up your mind file like a computer file, and your consciousness living indefinitely. And I was discussing some of the stuff with him, and I brought up that particular scenario, and he said, and you know, as Dad has a, you know, philosophical and a religious background as a minister, as a priest, as a Episcopalian priest.
Also as a historian and a linguist as well. He studied classical languages. True. Yeah, so, yeah, go ahead.
But anyway, you know, I posed him with those questions, and he said, you know, living forever and all that stuff, getting away from disease and death, he's like, isn't that what every religion in the world, for the most part, wants, is to live indefinitely and you know, and always have that consciousness, but the body is kind of irrelevant? And I thought, wow, that is pretty profound when you think about it, because, you know, and it makes me think of another thing that I heard the other day, because I was watching a TED presentation, as I tend to do, and I absolutely adore TED. I think that
he's a great guy.
Presentations are just amazing. But I was watching this TED presentation where this guy was talking about, and I unfortunately cannot remember his name, but he was talking about how aging is the number one cause of death. I thought that was really funny. I mean, it's like,
seems like a no-brainer, you know, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, we go through all this trouble to take care of our bodies and you know, pump ourselves full of vitamins and exercise, only to inevitably die. And I know that, you know, up until, you know, recently, we had some of these ideas. Who knows if we'll ever even really see them? You know, it seems like it could, but there's a possibility that it couldn't, so you never know. But now that we have these kind of ideas floating around that we actually can live indefinitely, and then you look at some, you know, people are starting to look at these things a different way, and you look at somebody like Ray Kurzweil, who actually used to take 200 supplements a day to help reprogram his biology, and now he's cut back to about 150 a day. But he says that his doctors have, like, shown him that because of his supplemental intake, he has literally only aged 2 years in the past 18 years.
That's
he
incredible.
Had type 1, I believe it was type 1 diabetes, but, you know, took the supplements that would replenish whatever parts in his body, you know, the insulin or whatever, the problems he was having, and he cured himself. That's not a very common thing, but it really shows you that if we look into these things and we just look to problem solve, that any of these, you know, aging problems, something like that, I think it's completely feasible that these things could be inevitably weaned out.
So what Ray Kurzweil is primarily, I mean, I consider him an inventor, you know, a futurist, a visionary of sorts. Some even would call him a prophet. But, you know, I think that primarily what he is he's a person who's trying to better the human experience, you know, and make make living more, enjoyable. And yes, religion, at least, I think, you have to be careful when you say these sorts of things. But I think that in principle, all religions would hope to try and better someone's existence. If their religion doesn't do that, I don't see why anyone would want to adhere to that. You know, religions typically, are aimed at trying to, not only make our time here on this planet better and more enjoyable, but they also tend to, try and, to be conducive to our survival as a species and, in culture and society. Unfortunately, as we see with some, extreme circumstances, that's not always the case. But generally, I think this is the aim of religion. That is very much the sort of thing that Kurzweil aims to do, not just through robotics and nanotechnology, but also through the use of, holistic supplements and, dietary things and exercise. I mean, he really is looking to better the human experience for people and make them happier and help them live longer.
Definitely.
Yeah, so, and again, I don't see really what's so controversial about that. But, now this fellow Paul Allen, he pointed out some other things. One of the biggest issues that he took with Ray Kurzweil and the claims that Kurzweil has made is that he says, while we think a fine-grained understanding of the neural structure of the brain is ultimately achievable, it has not shown itself to be the kind of area in which we can make exponentially accelerating progress, which Kurzweil claims. And in fact,
That's kind of funny that you cited that particular quote, because I actually had stewed on that one for a minute. I'm always, me the consummate. I try not to be as optimistic as I always am, because sometimes that gets me a little bit ahead of myself. But just saying theoretically, and the idea that we would be able to infuse ourselves with nanotechnology, and therefore basically we become not just the person and the computer, but the person and the computer within them. The person and the computer merge, they become the same thing. At that point, it's theorized that we'd basically be able to go into a virtual reality website or anything like that, kind of in the style of the Matrix. Any vast amount of information that's out there in the internet cloud could be downloaded to your brain instantly. And you have to think about that. When you look into things that are science, like neurology, and things that are so completely complex to us, and we've spent years and years and years, it kind of seems silly to me, really, to think that if we got to a point to where we could download all kinds of vast, huge informational capacities into our brains, that, at that point we wouldn't be able to maybe have a little bit more insight than our biological brains do now, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I kind of feel like at that point our brains we would be supercomputers, and that sort of gets into the idea of artificial intelligence. And a lot of people have this idea that, we're going to create AI, and AI is going to be this horrific tyrant that's going to look at the biological element and just be like...
Basically the Terminator movies, right?
We would basically just be, a cat, an insect, something like that. But the thing about it is if you also take into consideration that along the way, if we were to upgrade ourselves technologically, we wouldn't just be that biological element. And I really feel like the existence of an AI would probably be quite benign as to where we wouldn't just be biological anymore. We would be partly technological. And at that point, we would use AI basically how we use a computer now to supersede what transactions or whatever our brains can do and, help augment it. So basically, we would create the AI. The AI would infuse ourselves technologically, and the AI would springboard back into us after it supersedes human technology and help us supersede it as well. It's, a growing process either way for biology, I think, really. I don't think anything about the singularity is supposed to get rid of biology. If anything, I think it's really supposed to be preserving it in the best way it possibly can, understanding it better. Because it really is a miracle, biological life is an absolute miracle. It's so complex and it's so diverse and it's just, it's incredible.
It certainly
nothing
is.
Else you can say, really.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's something that almost escapes words. But that's the thing is that, you know, trying to... I'm sorry. I think we just had a Homo Mechanicus step into the studio here. But, I think that's a... He was all jangly. I saw his electronic man parts. Anywho, no.
My mouse flew off the table.
Yeah, no. I think what it was there was a visitor from the future that grabbed your mouse, Chris, and threw it across the room. That or the Hadals are back at the bunker, and I hope that's not the case.
If the Hadals have teak, I'm out of here.
Teak? What?
Telekinesis.
Oh, shh. We're going to have to go into the cone of silence again. We have to watch that one. Caleb, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I do want to ask you one more thing. You know, obviously, yeah. I think that, you know, Kurzweil and you know, Ben Goetzel, you know, a lot of these, Werner Vinge, of course, they're all very influenced, some of them more than others, by science fiction. In fact, Werner Vinge and Goetzel, also Jacques Vallée, you know, the article we have at GraylianReport.com today that I've put up, actually, it shows a picture of me, a now famous photograph of me holding Kurzweil's book. But it talks about a 1975 essay that last week's guest, Dr. Maxim Kammerer, sent to me that essentially shows that in as far back as 1975, Vallée, along with a co-author named Francois Meyer, were talking about the singularity. They were talking about technological singularity, and they, much like Kurzweil, who says that the singularity event will essentially begin to occur, I think that the proper term for that is what Kurzweil calls the knee of the curve. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Okay. Well, essentially what Jacques Vallée and Meyer said back in 1975 was that, you know, essentially the same sort of thing would begin to happen, that there would be a rapid expansion of technological growth that might exceed the capacity of the human brain, and that some of this would spill over into data systems, information systems, and other technological innovations of that day, and they estimated it would occur around 2026. Very interesting that so many people are, you know, really in the same neighborhood with all this, but I noticed that Jacques Vallée also has been a writer of science fiction, and of course people who listen to this program will also know he is, you know, one of the world's leading ufologists. Do you think that interest in sci-fi is kind of, does it run in tandem with these notions of biological and technological singularity, and do you think that the notions that are of a matrix-like reality, like what we see in films like The Matrix, is something that's completely removed and entirely fictional, or could that be maybe not entirely like in the film The Matrix, in terms of it being something that's detrimental to human life on planet Earth? But do you think that at least something similar to that could actually await us in the future?
I think definitely. I think that art really fuels, like, you know, people see Star Wars and they want to build a lightsaber, then you have some genius out there that eventually builds one. I think that art and inspiration and the human desire to create and, you know, our interest in everything, our curiosity, I think that those things really run in tandem with everything, as far as even our economic drive, our economic, you know, system, and how money is, you know, spun around in the whole big pot. Because I mean, if you look at it really, I mean, like, people are thinking, you know, jobs are going downhill and everything's going to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. But you know, really, with some of these emerging technologies, you know, some jobs are still being created and things like that. Technology is not dying here. In fact, if anything, it's really, you know, furthering and furthering. But as far as like projection of what the movies were kind of having an influence on what actual technologies come out of it, I think completely. I mean, if you look at some kid that probably watched Buck Rogers back in the day, you can't tell me there's not a NASA scientist that works right now that wasn't a huge fan of Buck Rogers back in the day.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it has a complete influence on it. And to be perfectly honest, when it comes down to like virtual realities and being able to go into virtual realities, and this is a very hopeful thing that I like to bring up, if you think about it, with the way the computing gaming graphics are all getting just better and better and better, and like if you look at the new Steven Spielberg film, The Adventures of Tintin, those computer graphics are just getting, you know, better and better. Can you imagine what we'll have in 20 years? And can you imagine once we go into virtual reality states? I always like to think about this. Everything, and you have to look at the good and the bad. Your most beautiful dreams and your most horrific nightmares, everything that you've ever been able to dream of or think, could probably be in virtual reality, and you could actually live them if the nanotechnology infuses with the neurons in your brains, and basically every feeling, everything you could touch, every temperature, everything like that, you would feel just like you actually feel on Earth. So everything that you could ever dream of, you could actually live in a singularity world.
It's very interesting. There's always good with the bad, I suppose. But, you know, we'll have to leave it right there for now. Caleb, listen, thank you very much for joining us on the program. And also, real quick, please plug your website and also tell us a little bit about, you know, where people can hear more of your music.
I'm Caleb Hanks. I'm the lead singer of a band called The Nova Echo. You can find us at thenovaecho.com. And we have a bunch of free music on there. If you like it, it's all yours. So if you like following me, you can follow me there or find me on Facebook at facebook.com/Caleb.Hanks, I believe is it. But either way, just search me and you can find me.
Excellent. That's Caleb Hanks. He's quite brilliant. Caleb, we always appreciate you bringing your correspondence here. You're a field correspondent here at the Grayling Report. There's no relation between us. We just have the same last name. I'm kidding, folks. He's my brother. Thanks, Caleb. We appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me. Night, guys.
And good night, Caleb. And we appreciate that, as always, from the technological forefront of our Grayling staff here at Grayling International Headquarters. That is my younger brother. Hey, we had to give him a job, but you know what? He does a fantastic job every time he comes on the program, lending his insights into transhumanism and the future of humanity. It's certainly an interesting circumstance, and God knows where we'll end up. It's almost terrifying to think sometimes, but like we said, there's always good with the bad, and it's equally beautiful. Also, I guess it comes down to being a philosophical matter of perspective. When we come back, we'll touch on this a little bit more. I think we've pretty much summed up Ray Kurzweil's views on the things, and appreciate Caleb's insights on that. But what about UFOs? How do they play into all this? More on that when we come back here on the Grayling Report.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Hey, what's up? Holla at ya, boy. XOXOXO. You getting these texts? Question mark. Where are you? What are you doing? OMG, you are making me mad. You better text me back. I'm waiting outside your house.
Relentless, aggressive texting is like sending an angry robot to deliver your message. When does the robot become dangerous? Let us know at thatsnotcool.com.
Thatsnotcool.com.
Brought to you by the Ad Council. Thanks for asking, but I'd rather not send you nude pictures. I'm camera shy. I already said no. Under my clothes, I'm a robot. My webcam is broken. I'm worried they'll get passed around school. I have a rash. I have nudophobia. I have lizard skin. I'm a vampire, so I don't show up in pictures anyways. Your badgering has really killed the mood.
When someone is pressuring you to do something you don't want to, how many ways can you say no before they get the message? Let us know at thatsnotcool.com. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
We'll be right back.
high mountains of Appalachia. It's the Grailian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Grailian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grailian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
We're the kind of guys who try and grow little bioorganisms from Vegemite in Petri dishes every week. We are your ambassadors of the unexplained. It is the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, borrowing quips and quotes from my producer between the breaks. Thanks again to our field correspondent on futurism and technology, Mr. Caleb Hanks, for joining us on the program. He might be my younger brother, but he's highly qualified to speak about such matters, as all our field correspondents certainly are. We enjoy having them on the program. And frankly, you know, that's one thing I love about doing this program is that, you know, I've worked, in talk radio for years. I've done, you know, libertarian programs. I've done conservative programs. I've done progressive liberal programs. Not as a host. I've worked, you know, in production and engineering for various programs. I've hosted both in a political format and, of course, doing this sort of format, talking about paranormal and the unexplained. And, being the middle-of-the-road kind of person with not just a constant interest in, you know, who's saying what at what debate or who showed up at what Tea Party rally saying this or what or that, you know. I'm pretty diverse in my interest, and I don't like having to stick to one single subject. I like talking about what's in the news, what matters to people, and I think the things that we need to be keeping an eye on in terms of what's going to be going on tomorrow. And that's why we talk about transhumanism and future emerging technology, UFOs, and occasionally, you know, politics and economics here on this program, because these are all things that, to me, if you don't think they matter right now, just wait. Just wait, because they will. And you'll find out that this is going to all be the sort of thing that we talk about on this program, the Grailian Report. I do believe is the very sort of subject matter that will become fundamental to all our lives in the coming years. And the people who listen to this program are the enlightened few who are getting a little sneak peek at tomorrow, or at very least the potentials that tomorrow holds. No one really knows what lays around that clandestine corner, but we do our best to report on that, and that's why we have field correspondents. As opposed to getting the same guests on this program, you know, that are on all the paranormal programs talking all the time. You know, I mean, Nick Redfern's popular as a guest on a lot of programs, but you know what? He's a field correspondent for the Grailian Report. We have, as a matter of fact, I'm actually one of his correspondents for the Center of Fortean Zoology here in the United States, which is an organization that's overseen by John Downs, based out of the UK. You know, a lot of us in the paranormal communities help one another out in that capacity, and I'm very proud to have people like Nick Redfern, who will literally just jump on for 15 or 20 minutes, you know, by phone. We don't arrange a lot of this stuff in advance. We try and, you know, plan out what we're going to talk about on the program, but it always inevitably goes in some direction that we didn't expect, you know, whether it's Nick Redfern jumping on, or if it's, you know, Intrepid Magazine publisher and editor Scotty Roberts jumping on the program just to chime in on something, you know. Like last week, you know, we had booked Dr. Maxim Kammerer for a very rare interview. And everyone listening to the podcast, and also those listening online right now, you know, I hope people enjoyed that interview. It was heady. It was very, you know, intellectual. But the information and the subject matter being addressed, you're not going to hear that kind of thing anywhere else. That is something that you will only hear on programs, well, like this, on this program, for that matter. And you know, Mike Cleland, who illustrated Mac Tony's blog, or not his blog, but his book, The Cryptoterrestrials, Mac Tony's, you know, final book, you know, having Mike Cleland call into the program unexpected like that, you know, it's incredible. But that's the kind of magic that happens on this program. You know, we've got a lot of friends and experts in different fields of the strange and the unusual, news, fringe science, politics, you know, the unexplained, the occult, cryptozoology, all these kinds of things, and you know, people who are willing to lend their insights and really bring a diverse melting pot of information that is of interest to our listeners. But, you know, aside from the field correspondents and the people who contribute to this program and provide news and insight, you know, we also rely on you, the listeners. We certainly rely on people out there who are listening to this program to provide us with feedback and let us know what you like to hear on this program and the things that you'd like to hear more of, and maybe the things that you'd like to hear less of as well. You know, we've kind of talked about singularity for the last couple of weeks. Probably won't be on the table a week from today. In fact, I'll tell you what will be on the table a week from today. We had lined up for tonight's program, a guest, you know, who is really probably one of the more entertaining guests that we will have had on the program all year. It is the month of what we call Croctober here on the Grayling Report. And we've been, although, you know, celebrating Croctober all month leading up to Halloween, you know, things, as I say often and as I've said just now, tend to kind of go their own way when we're doing this program. And
Fleetwood Mac style.
Fleetwood Mac style, exactly. And I had initially planned to have you're going to laugh, but, you know, go ahead. Thank you, Reverend. We had a vampire hunter and a psychic investigator booked for this program tonight. Yes, for this radio program. It wasn't a zombie hunter. It was just a vampire hunter, Chris.
But, well, first of all, vampires are zombies, too.
Really?
Yeah.
You learn something every day, I guess. Right?
Anything that dies and comes back to life are zombies.
We went over that.
Mummies, yeah. Vampires. We went over that the first episode, yeah, Micah.
Months ago. I apologize.
But for a minute, I thought, since you said a vampire hunter, that you were going to have Jonathan the Impaler Sharky on.
No, not that vampire hunter. No, we were going to have...
No, he's a vampire, not a vampire hunter.
Oh, yeah, I want to hunt him.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. No, we were going to have a vampire hunter. He's an old friend of mine, and he's a fellow who actually would be coming to us live from across the pond. David Ferrant, who is the president of the British Psychic and Occult Society, he was one of the lead investigators in a very strange and sordid tale that unraveled in the early 1970s involving a literal report of a strange, caped, red-eyed fiend that was seen stalking around Highgate Cemetery in North London during the early 1970s. It was none other than the case of the Highgate Vampire, and David Ferrant is, you know, I think that, you know, his history is very interesting. David is, you know, certainly not always been given a fair shake at things. And in fact, I'll just tell you this, because we discussed this prior to, you know, hoping to set up an interview, and he had to cancel at the last minute because there'd been an emergency issue, and he apologized and said, if you don't mind, I'll reschedule and we'll come on the program next week. So next week, we will have David Ferrant. And I've been wondering how I really want to do that, you know, because, I mean, Halloween falls on Monday, but we do our show on Tuesdays, so we could celebrate Halloween a day late, I guess, or we could do a special Halloween broadcast. I mean, I don't know. What should we do?
We could have a special Halloween broadcast because since the 31st is on Halloween, the 31st is a Monday, no one's going to be having any raging keggers because they got all that out of the way on the weekend.
Yeah, see, so I'm celebrating Halloween on Saturday night, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one's going to be going out unless they're really hardcore like me, but I'll be here, so you can be here too.
So we're going to be in the studio on Monday night doing the show.
Hell yeah.
Okay, well, okay, folks, you heard that here then. It looks like Monday night we're going to be trying to do a live special Halloween broadcast, and it is our hope this time that we will succeed in getting our vampire hunter friend from across the great pond, the great waters that make up the Atlantic Ocean, David Ferrant, the president of the British Psychic and Occult Society. He, in addition to having, you know, studied the actual alleged presence of a vampire-like entity in North London's Highgate Cemetery in the 1970s. David Ferrant also is, you know, a renowned ghost hunter and spiritualist and occult investigator. You know, I don't think that everyone would agree with his spiritual views, you know, and his ideological views on a lot of things, but I know this in my experience, you know, having corresponded with and known David for a number of years. You know, he's a good-hearted person. I think that he's not always been given a fair shake. You know, in fact, I'll tell you this, as a result of some of his investigations and things, he was wrongly accused of a number of vandalisms that occurred in Highgate Cemetery and actually did some time in prison for those. Interestingly enough, while Ferrant was serving his short sentence in prison, the vandalisms occurred and continued to occur in his you know, absence, his inability to actually be there present to continue these vandalisms. So it was pretty clear that Ferrant had not been the individual who had been out there engaging in vandalism at Highgate Cemetery, and he always had said that all along, and despite the fact that he had been incarcerated, while vandalisms continued to take place, you know, the police force there in London still gave him a hard time. You know, and that is, in a sense, maybe something to be admired. You know, someone who sticks by their guns and, you know, maintains, you know, their passion for what they do, And David Ferrant has certainly done that for several decades. So he's an interesting fella. He's a, you know, a friend of the program. And, of course, you know, well, he's a real-life vampire hunter. And we're going to have him on the program next week to wrap up the month of Croctober here on the Grailian Report. You know, it hasn't been quite as creepy and ghoulish as I had thought it would be. But, again, taking the good with the bad, I'm very thankful that this program, as opposed to being something that we structure rigidly and say it has to be this, it has to be that, you know, you have to make it this, we have to have this certain guest on, we have to have a guest on every week and let them talk and, you know, do all these questions and everything. You know, a lot of the time it's really more, you know, flying by the seat of our pants. What are we going to do on the program tonight? This was in the news. Which field correspondent can handle this? Let's get them on the program. You know, we've got this guest that's going to come on during hour two, as opposed to spending 3 hours talking with that person. Let's have them on for 20 minutes, get an update, you know, get a focused interview with that person, and then move on to something else. And that way we can cover more material. And we've got a lot of stuff. And of course, you know, a good 3 hours to do it. But as you know, my dear listeners, that 3 hours goes by very quickly. Who knows? We're going to be doing a broadcast on Monday. Now, are we going to move Tuesday's broadcast to Monday? Are we going to do a Monday and a Tuesday? Or hell, are we just going to start going 8 to 11 weeknights? Is that what we're going to do? Is that what this is leading up to? Is the Grailian Report going to be at, Matt Oakley's like, no. Uh-uh.
No, we're going to be coming to you 3 hours a day, 1 hour increments. So you get us three times a day, every day for 3 hours.
Okay.
Total.
Wait, hold on. Say that again.
You get us 3 hours a day in 1 hour increments. Okay. So we're going to broadcast three separate times throughout the day, but only for 1 hour.
Every day. So we're going to do like 8 a.m., and then we're going to do 4 p.m., and then we're going to do 8 p.m.
So you guys get 21 shows a week.
21 little shows.
Tiny shows.
Tiny shows.
Vignettes.
Do your tiny show.
And we still have to run ads and everything, so it'll just be like, hey, guys, just checking in.
Well, hey, we got to go pay the bills. Blah, 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 blah. And we're back. Oh, wait, we got to go pay the bills again. But I just want everyone out there listening to know, I've decided, because of a few people in the chat room, well, one person in the chat room, fine, Red Pill Junkie, I've decided I'm going to issue myself a challenge.
Uh-oh, we got another challenge.
My challenge to myself is, it won't be like within a week or two, it may not even be within a month or two, but my goal is at least by the end of first quarter 2012 to have as a guest on our program.
Oh boy.
Alex Jones.
Really?
Yes.
We're going to get Alex Jones on the show.
I'm going to try to get Alex Jones on the show, which means we can't make fun of him from now until then.
Okay, that's fine. I like Alex Jones, though. Can I still impersonate Alex Jones?
Yeah, actually, Red Pill Junkie would like more Alex Jones screams.
More Alex Jones screams, you know, because I don't think fundamentally that people really know what we have to put up with here on this program. They don't know what kind of trouble goes into doing what we do. They don't know what we have to go through on a week-by-week basis. Never mind, sorry, I was getting a little worked up. I love Red Pill Junkie. He's a great guy.
That wasn't the yell.
Is that a little better?
There it is.
That was what we were looking for. Anyway, well, on that note, to all our dear listeners, we have one more hour that we're going to spend with you here on the Grailian Report this week. And in the meantime, yeah, I guess we're going to have to put a hiatus on our Alex Jones mocking. You know, I have profound respect for Alex Jones. He's probably the only guy in the business saying what he says and doing it the way he does. And frankly, probably the only one that could do
it as loud as he does.
Yeah, he's the only guy who could do it the way that he does. Anyway, I'm Micah Hanks. I'm one of a kind. We'll be back right after this.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com. IntrepidMag.com. Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Coming to you like a boss, it's Tuesday nights. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio by another couple of bosses.
Is that you?
No, no, I was talking about you.
Nah, you're... man, that's not me.
Nope.
That ain't me.
I'm pretty sure that was actually you.
Nope.
That's right. No, Chris
says I throw it on the ground.
You threw it on the ground? What did you throw on the ground, Chris?
Happy birthday to the ground.
Happy birthday. Has anybody seen that? Have y'all out there in our listening audience? I'm sorry there. My southern inflection just came in. Y'all.
Have y'all done seen that show SNL? Hey. You know, they got that Andy Samberg fellow. You know,
he does
some funny songs on the TV.
Them
on the
fine
TV looky box.
Them fine folks up there in New York City, they some funny types, ain't they?
New York City! I get my salsa from El Paso, Texas.
No, I gotta put my
Look at all them buildings!
Oh, lit up from the inside.
Folks, they'll be here all night, I promise. Welcome back to the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, joined in studio by a couple of bosses. And actually, Chris Hayes is my boss. He really is. I have to be careful. He's not just like a boss. He is my boss.
I'm going to crack the whip.
Please don't. Actually, I think we're all each other's bosses. You know, is that socialism? Is that weird? I don't know. Anyway,
yeah.
Welcome back to the program. We were talking about biological singularity last hour. You know, I've been mean. I've been neglecting listeners' emails. Bill writes, what do jungle drums, breaking glass, and machine gun fire have to do with your podcast? They're coming through where the missing part of the podcast should be. First of all, I should just say that's impossible, and let me tell you why. Because if you're listening to it right now, it's not a podcast, it's an audio stream.
And we live nowhere near the jungle.
Yeah, that's just impossible. No, no, I'm just kidding.
I think they may be the Hadal drums out there.
War drums?
Yeah, the Hadal.
War drums.
You might be picking that up.
You remember that scene in Return of the Jedi where it's like Boba Fett's up there, and then Han Solo's like, Boba Fett? Boba Fett? Where? Like, you say Hadal anything. Hadal war drums. War drums? War drums? No, I know what Bill's talking about. Here's what Bill's talking about. Right now, our stream is hosted through a fantastic service called Ustream. Now, if you download the podcast, you get to listen to this program commercial-free. But those who tune in live, unfortunately, at present, are subjected to advertisements that pop up on the Ustream feed from time to time. But you know what? Guess what? Our website went down a few weeks ago, and we ended up having to remove our podcast from the server because there were some bandwidth issues, and we were able to get at least a good chunk of them back online. Now, you know, in the coming months, we're also going to try and, you know, get the other audio, which is all backed up, of course. We're going to get that back on our server so that people can download, you know, many, many, many past editions of this program, because there are so many. My God, there are dozens of episodes of this program that people, you know, soon will be able to download. We're going to get the archives entirely updated, and you can visit www.graylianreport.com and download, you know, all your favorite episodes and listen to, you know, God knows what. We've had so many guests and different subjects and things, you know, span the cosmos and run the gamut and all that other good stuff, you know. So there's a lot of content that we've featured on the program. We want to make it all available to you. And, of course, as always, we provide this to you presently for free. But, you know, some things do come at a cost. We do end up having to, you know, pay for not only, you know, just the bandwidth and the server storage space that we're using right now to store the podcast, but we also, in the future, hope to be able to provide a commercial-free stream, an independently served stream that, you know, literally will be accessible from the Graylian Report website. So as opposed to, you know, having to go to the Graylian Report and then visit our Ustream page, or go to, you know, Twitter or Facebook or wherever that you have heard about this and then launch the Twitter or the Ustream feed, you'll be able to go to the Grey Alien Report and launch a player right there from the website. There'll be an interactive chat where you can chat with people in the chat room, and you can interact with others who are listening to the program in real time. But, you know, as is always the case, that sort of thing costs money. It always costs money to be able to do that. And the problem, of course, erupts around the fact that, you know, when we're providing, you know, services for free, because we believe in, here at the Grey Alien Report, you know, the free exchange of knowledge and ideas. We use this program as a medium for those kinds of ideas. And unfortunately, when we don't charge for it, it you know, sometimes does become difficult to provide these things. Now, there's a bit of revenue that comes in from other areas, you know, and we're hoping to have some fantastic products in the future that, you know, and I'm not talking about, you know, rubber doggy doo-doo from Hong Kong and stuff like that. You know, we're not going to be hawking our souls and our integrity just to sell products to be able to, you know, pay our server costs and keep things online. A lot of people have told us to do that. That's not the case. Now, here's the general plan. First of all, are you an advertiser? Do you have a product? Would you like to have thousands of people a month hear about it here on the Grey Alien Report? I'm not kidding. Let me just tell you this. In addition to, you know, a decent number of people who listen to this live program every Tuesday evening, there are thousands, I kid you not, who download this podcast every month. And the listenership is just growing and growing. It nearly grew by a third only after our website went down. I tell you, they say absence makes the heart grow fonder, and that couldn't have been truer. When our websites went down a couple of weeks ago, we had such a comeback. The listenership grew so much. I mean, we were all sitting in here in Grey Alien Studios going, good gracious, what is going on here? And every week there are more and more people who tune in and listen to the program live, and when we're able to provide a live stream for people, that's going to become even better because it's going to be more interactive. You know, the stream quality will be better. There's going to be a lot of, you know, benefits from that kind of thing. But it does take time, and it takes patience, and of course it does take money on our side. So, you know, as opposed to, you know, hawking ourselves and doing all this kind of thing, you know, what we do want to say is, you know, if you're an advertiser and you'd like to advertise here on the program, you know, I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritties right now, but if someone is interested seriously in advertising, we can give you a breakdown of the listenership, you know, and what can be offered to you from this program, you know, and work with something that will work with you to help you advertise your product here on this program. Something else that we can do is we can ask you, if, you know, if you don't have a product or something like that, you know, but you'd like to help us anyway, you can visit greylianreport.com and there's a PayPal donate button right there. You can actually donate a small amount to this operation. Every little bit helps. You know, I've had folks from the United Kingdom and parts of the United States, you know, and other areas, you know, who've donated money, and they're like, you know, I apologize because, you know, I don't have very much money, and it's a small amount, but this is what I can afford. And I always tell people who say that, it's like, you know, it's people who give those small amounts knowing that you probably didn't have a whole lot of money to give to begin with, and you did anyway. You know, I'm most thankful for you. That is incredibly moving to us and meaningful to us that, you know, it meant enough to someone, you know, to actually help support this program. They enjoy listening to this program enough that they would actually want to donate money and help us improve this operation and keep the boat afloat, so to speak. You know, that to me is incredibly important, and no amount, truly, truly, I mean this, no amount is so small that is insignificant or unhelpful. Every little bit counts, and the small amounts given by people who couldn't afford any more, that means as much, if not more, you know, in some cases, than, you know, somebody giving $100 or $200. We don't get a lot of those, but the truth is that, you know, there have been some people who have, you know, generously, you know, contributed, you know, what they could. And for that, we are so thankful. That means a lot to us. And I hope it means a lot to you, too. I hope that people enjoy this program on a weekly basis. It's entertaining, it's fun, but it's also informative. You know, it's a forum, not only for ideas, but for learning and also to a degree for expression. You know, we always put that out there to people who want to call in the program. If you got something on your mind and you want to sound off, call us. Tell us about it, you know? There are a lot of things you can get away with talking about and saying, you know, on the web that, unfortunately, you know, FCC-regulated, you know, daytime radio airwaves, you know, you can't. I'm not telling people to call in here and, you know, be obscene, but I'm saying that, you know, we have a certain degree of control over more controversial and, frankly, less mainstream subject matter. That's why we're able to talk about UFOs and strange phenomena as often as we do. You know, we don't have corporate monkeys jumping down our backs telling us what we have to talk about and which political candidates we can't talk about and what we can and cannot address. You know, they don't have people telling us that this guest, because that person is too smart or too intellectual, won't sound good on the program, and this guy's too controversial because he went on such and such's program last week and said this, that, and the other. You know, we have independent operation here at Graylin International, and therefore we also have a good degree of control over the content that we provide. You know, and the numbers we are seeing from week to week show us, without question, that, you know, what we're doing is resonating with people like you. That, you know, that you are learning something, that you're enjoying it. And damn, if we don't enjoy bringing it to you on a weekly basis. For that, my dear friends in Radio Land, I must thank you wholeheartedly. From the bottom of my ever-loving, sweet, humble Southern heart, your little mouth of the South is going to be here for as long as he needs to be until we get the job done. Isn't that right? And I got a couple of real good guys here in the studio who help us. And others. There are too many to name right now, but I'll leave it at that for the time being. Thank all of you here, and of course, all of you out there listening. Thank you so much for your contributions and the help that you provide. It means a lot, and things are only going to get better. In the coming weeks, we do indeed hope to be able to migrate our stream to a commercial-free format. When I say commercial-free, I'm talking about, I mean, our sponsorships, our advertisements will still play, but the program will not be interrupted by, as Bill wrote in and mentioned, you know, jungle drums and machine guns and things, because, you know, if I were Bill, I wouldn't want to hear that on this program either, unless the Hadals were attacking again and it was the sound of us winning against them.
Well, speaking of ads that sound like jungle drums and machine guns and such, I have been informed by Ustream that, it went away. An ad will begin in 7 minutes and 23 seconds, and it's Ustream's ad, not our ad, so if we get cut off, it's not our fault.
You know, see, that's the thing. And again, I'm not just trying to hit people up for money by any means. You know, that's not why we're telling people this. I just want to give people an explanation, you know, that presently we like to be able to provide this program in a live format. We talked about that for a long time. You know, I used to do the Mike and Hanks radio program live, but the problem with doing a live program is that people can't take it with them and listen to it on demand. This program began as a podcast because people wanted to be able to take it with them on demand, and that's still where the largest portion of our listenership is. But the other aspect of that is that, you know, despite there being, you know, a large listenership who takes this program, downloads it, and listens to it on iPhones and iPods and things and computers and, you know, cell phones and God knows what, there are people who like to be able to listen to it live. They love the live interactivity. They like to be able to call in. They like to be able to send us emails and interact with us while we're live on the air, and know that when they are listening to this program, there are live bodies in a studio behind 3 microphones in a bunker hundreds of miles below the Earth's surface somewhere out there in the dark hills of the Appalachian Mountains, which is where we are right now. And this is why we do what we do, the way we do, when we do, for you. And so, indeed, you know, you can help us improve. I'm not going to beg, but, you know, people who want to help improve this program, you can, you know, you can visit www.graylinreport.com. You can click the PayPal donate button. That will help. But you don't have to give money. You know, I know not everyone right now in these economically woeful times can do that. And we appreciate your support and your listenership alone. That in itself means a lot. So anyway, moving on to other things. We talked about this singularity thing during the last hour. And sure, there were some criticisms leveled against Mr. Kurzweil. I think he defends himself pretty well, and certainly our field correspondent, Caleb Hanks, did a fantastic job, you know, discussing that entire situation. And frankly, I think maybe for the time being, so as not to, you know, I've heard a lot of talk show hosts, they'll get on one subject or another, you know, and that's all you'll hear about for weeks, you know, sometimes because it's newsworthy. I'll just tell you this. I think it's interesting, and it's a subject we touch on frequently on this program, but Ray Kurzweil and the singularity isn't that newsworthy right now that we need to spend a whole other hour talking about it. So I'm going to leave well enough alone and say that, you know, our field correspondent, who is far more well-versed in such matters than I am, Caleb Hanks, he did a fantastic job. And anything that may not have been clear, you know, you can actually I wonder what the best way to contact him is. I think he gave his information out during the last hour there, probably through the Nova Echo website, but there's probably an email, and I would tell people, you know, you could either, of course, send emails to info@graylinreport.com, or you can contact Caleb directly at his NovaEcho.com website. That's his band. But if you do send queries and questions to Caleb Hanks through me, we'll be certain that they, you know, you can contact any of the field correspondents for this program, for that matter, directly through the website. info@graylianreport.com is the email address, and we'll make sure those get to who they need to get to. That said, we'll move along maybe to something else. There was another interesting story that caught my eye, and this one, I learned about it really just before we took the air this evening. Discovery News talked about it, about a mysterious cipher code that was recently cracked. Did you guys hear about this one?
I brought it up to you when we were doing our pre-show prep.
Oh, did you find it? Oh, okay. See, I'd found it too.
Well, I didn't find it for you, but we found it together. Up and you said,
oh, I'm going to talk about that on the show.
On the show.
Just on the show.
We're going to talk about it on the show. Yeah, I think it's called the Copiale Cipher. It's a 105-page book that was written in a combination of elaborate symbols and what appear to be Roman letters. You know what they really look a lot like are the runes, you know, from the Lord of the Rings films, okay? But previous attempts to decode this 105-page book have all failed. It was clear that the cipher being used was, well, more sophisticated than most. This book is located in the former East Germany and was signed by a man only known as Philip, dated 1866. Now, Kevin Knight, a computer scientist at the Information Sciences Institute at the University of Southern California, collaborated with two colleagues, Beata Megiski and Christiana Schaefer of Uppsala University. They found that the text was in a sophisticated substitution cipher, which means that the letters one would expect were replaced with symbols. Such ciphers are common in children's games. You might remember the Pigpen cipher, or shifting letters, making A into a C, a B into a D, and so on from grade school. I think another popular example is in newspapers each week. They're called cryptoquotes. You probably played the cryptoquote game where each letter represents a different letter. And by figuring out patterns, for instance, if you find a three-letter word, then you might assume that it is something like and or the or but, some three-letter word that you could use, and you can try different combinations. When something starts to work, you can plug those different varying letters into other words, and then you start looking for combinations that work with those letters and the placement on the larger words, and eventually you figure out what the quote actually is based on spacing and letter placement and the number of letters per word and things like that. Well, that's kind of like what they were dealing with here. And they tried the same thing using these various unknown symbols. Again, they got nonsense, but the nonsense, get this, seemed to point to German as being the original language. Now imagine if you were doing one of these crypto quote puzzles, and while you're doing the puzzle, you don't know what language each of the letters that you're trying to decipher represents. Boy, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? And that's exactly what they were having to do here. But they began to think that maybe the symbols were originally intended to represent German. Knight and his team assumed that they were starting with German, as the book is from Germany, and Philipp, okay, it's actually spelled like the word Philip, but with two P's on the end. Well, it's a German spelling when they spell it that way. So they then looked at the frequency of the different symbols, and then where those symbols occurred together. This technique is centuries old and depends on the fact that different languages have combinations of letters that are allowed or not. For example, in English, Q is followed by a U in all but a few very rare words. And those are all, get this, foreign borrowings. So, you know, it's pretty easy to rule out, you know, the English usage when Q is involved, getting the P's and Q's in orders, right? But that gave a few letters, which in turn allowed them to pick out a few more, and eventually they were able to transcribe the entire text. They've only translated the first 16 pages, but what the Copiale cipher revealed was a set of rules and initiation rites, get this, for a secret society. Such societies were more common in the 18th and 19th centuries, both as political and social organizations. Yale's Skull and Bones Society was one of these. Another example might be Bohemian Grove, or even the Freemasons. The technique used on the Copiale manuscript, however, was more serious. It involved uses, it has more serious uses than plumbing the secrets of a secret society that has long disbanded. Knight notes that many of his algorithms can be used in machine translation. In other words, there are other applications involved in this cipher that he's used to decipher this, or decipher, literally, this manuscript. Knight also said that he had been very interested in one of the most famous coded texts. Now, this is a favorite of mine also. The Voynich manuscript, which has also stumped cryptographers and linguists for nearly a century. The Voynich is similar to the Copiale in that it is clearly some sort of coded text, but nobody is sure exactly what the original language it was in or the nature of the cipher, what they were trying to get across in the Voynich manuscript. You know, we have some friends at the Graelian Report here who may have some information about the Voynich manuscript, and that is a subject that is not discussed a lot.
I was actually going to bring that up.
The Voynich manuscript?
The Voynich manuscript. I was wondering if there's been any headway made into it.
Well, this fella, okay, behind this study, Kevin Knight, the computer scientist with the University of SoCal, he believes that he can perhaps maybe even apply this cipher that he used with the Copiali manuscript in trying to understand better what exactly the hidden message behind the famous Voynich manuscript may be. I would like to suggest that we try and get some information together about the Voynich and talk about that manuscript on a future edition of this program, because that has fascinated me for years. It is truly one of the more interesting, what would you call it? I don't know if you call it a sacred manuscript, but it's certainly esoteric, strange, occult. You know, it's very weird, and there seems to be a hidden meaning. But what is it? What is it? What is that manuscript detailing?
Well, one of the web comics that I follow really frequently, one is called XKCD, written by a guy. He's a mathematician, a physicist. He's like ultra uber smart and incredibly funny. He did a strip about the Voynich manuscript, probably a couple years ago. And they're talking. There's two characters in the manuscript in the comic strip talking about what it could be, and one of them says, "It's obvious." And the friend is, you know, flabbergasted. Obvious. Linguists and cryptographers have been stumped for decades. And the other friend who said it was obvious said they forget that human nature doesn't change. Just imagine someone found a book from our time full of lists, illustrations, tables, and long, dry descriptions of non-existent words written in an invented language. What would they have found? And the friend is like, "Dear Lord, it is obvious." And then it flashes to 500 years earlier, they're playing, you know, Renaissance Dungeons and Dragons.
All right.
It's a dungeon master guide.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, that's interesting, you know. But, I mean, that theory almost works as well as anything, you know. And I've wondered sometimes that when these manuscripts show up, I wonder, honestly, if people don't put too much stock in the hope that there is something meaningful behind these sorts of manuscripts. You know, in other words, I wonder sometimes if the hope that there is some sort of clandestine knowledge to be revealed doesn't, you know, lend itself far more to the intrigue that these manuscripts hold than any actual meaning that may be underlying. Now, in the case with this, you know, Copiali script, you know, that Kevin Knight and his team worked with, it was very much the case that they were dealing with some sort of a, you know, secret society workbook. But is the Voynich manuscript a dungeon master's guide, you know? A player handbook for those D&D gamers out there? I don't know.
Well, but, I mean, I wonder, you know, not that it's a D&D handbook or anything like that, but, you know, I've often thought, hey, why don't we just scribble on something permanent or semi-permanent that'll last for a long time? We're going to a break, aren't we?
Yeah, go ahead. Keep talking. You got time. You're a radio guy.
No, I'll bring it back at the end of the break.
You had plenty of time.
It's going to take like 10 minutes.
Well, I just didn't want to, you know, get interrupted by another one of those Usteam stream breaks. So anyway, I'm Micah Hanks with Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley. We'll be right back on the Graelian Report.
My name is Dale Pazinski, and this is how I live United. I volunteer with United Way, helping the homeless in my community by teaching computer skills and helping them build a basic resume to save on their very own USB drive. It's huge when somebody says, "Hey man, that job that you helped me apply for, I got it." My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
All right, guys, I know you've been putting it off. Your thirst for knowledge is incredible, insatiable, but your wallet says otherwise. So you haven't been able to subscribe to all those classy magazines out there bringing you to the edges of the fringe just like you and I do every week here on the Graelian Report. Well, good news for you. You can now subscribe to Intrepid Magazine for an entire year and just pay $19.95.
Really? That's it? It's no joke. 1995 will get you an entire year of incredible insight from authors like Nick Redfern, Scotty Roberts, and of course yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Visit www.intrepidmag.com today and feel your mind expanding tomorrow.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency, and 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
You know, I think my producer's just trying to scare the listenership. If you go to our Facebook page, oh, you haven't been to our Facebook page yet? Yeah, you got to go like us on Facebook. The Graylian Report now is on Facebook, and there is a official fan page courtesy of none other than Graylian producer Chris Hayes, who helped set that up. So now you can follow us, well, on Facebook as well as Twitter. We've been on Twitter for a while now, and of course now the Graylian Report is on Facebook. And if you go to our Facebook page, which is actually, Chris, would you give them the URL for that real quick?
For the Facebook page?
Yeah, well, yeah, because people, I mean, if you aren't friends with one of us on Facebook, you can still visit this fan book page. There's a URL for that.
I don't think I've set up the custom URL. I don't think it's, you know, facebook.com/thegraylianreport.
There is a custom URL, though, I believe. As a matter of fact, I tell you what, I'll get it for them real quick. But anyway, yeah. Point is that you can follow us now.
Or you can just search Graylian Report, sorry.
Yeah, do a search for Graylian Report. It's the Graylian Report. We're on Facebook. And actually, it should be facebook.com/pages/the-Graylian-report. And then we have a dash and then a series of numbers, which is 125-090-7309-32158. Yeah, so everybody's going to remember that.
Like I said, we don't have a custom one set up yet. I'll get on that.
That's okay. That's the next step, right, folks? But anyway, in the meantime, you can just do a search for The Graylian Report, and you can like us on Facebook, and of course, if you aren't already, you can follow us on Twitter. But up at our Graylian Report page, Chris Hayes has included a really weird photograph of yours truly. Chris is kind of an art photographer, I guess. And no, I'm not naked in the picture. Don't worry. No, it's this bizarre picture. I'm looking at it right now. It's me standing there with my arms outstretched, but I was moving when the picture was taken, and Chris simultaneously also did one of those things where he had the camera lens zoomed in on me, and he zoomed out as he was moving towards me. Is that how you did that? Something like that?
No, I had the shutter speed set pretty slowly, about actually 2 seconds. I had it set for a two-second shutter speed. I was zoomed all the way in on you.
Mm-hmm.
Zoomed it all the way out on you. I took the picture. As the shutter was closed, I slowly zoomed in.
I see.
Out. No. One of those. But no. It made that thing.
Okay,
happen.
So there's this photograph of me standing in a kitchen, and it literally looks like my soul is extending out of my body and coming over to say hi, kind of like Donnie Darko or something. It's really strange. So Chris put that up on the Graylian page to frighten everyone, this creepy Croctober evening. It is a creepy Croctober evening.
It's a wicked night.
It's a wicked night, Reverend, isn't it?
It is.
You know, I tell you, there's a lot of creepy stuff that goes on out there. Alien abduction and rooms inside of former presidents' nostrils and things like that. What were you rambling about a minute ago when it came to, you were talking about Abe Lincoln's nose or a room in his nostril cavity or something?
What it is, we were talking about the whole, like, you know, decoded messages and secret societies throughout history and stuff. So it got me thinking about, you know, these like National Treasure movies and stuff like that with Nicolas Cage. And it actually turns out I saw a television program the other day that did give a little validity to one of the things in those movies. Apparently there actually is a room behind Abraham Lincoln's head on Mount Rushmore.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. You see, I was thinking you were talking about like a room behind Abe Lincoln's head at the Lincoln, you know, monument.
I actually think they get to the room like through the nostril or something in the movie, though. I don't remember totally, but
I was right.
I think.
See, I'm usually right about these.
Not in real life, but in Nicolas Cage world. Huh. You know?
Well, what's in the room in real life? Do you know? Does anybody know?
I didn't end up finishing the actual program, but from what I can find online, apparently it's a bunch of like American history artifacts and documents and things like that.
Really?
That's allegedly what's back there.
So this is kind of, you know, speculative.
And the thing is I actually heard an interview with the guy who does the TV show, and he was saying, you know, we got to go back there, but we didn't get to go in the room. We got to film the door, and that's all you get to see. And they speculate and give evidence to what they believe is in the room, but again, I didn't get that far.
You know, that kind of ties in with a poll question that we put up on the Graylian Report fan page earlier this week, and that question was this. Actually, that's not the question. Here's the question. Do you think there are secretive organizations plotting to institute a new world order to control the global economy and other elements of people's lives? What are your thoughts? You know, you can log on to Facebook and you can answer that question just by scrolling down the page a little bit, and you'll see where we ask that. But you can also call into the program. It's always an option, too. If you'd like to call in before we run out of time, we are in the home stretch, less than half an hour left in tonight's broadcast, but those who are listening live can call us at 828-398-4886. Join us by phone, or you can reach us via Skype at Graylian Report on Skype. Do you think there are
secretive... We don't actually have a phone. We've got...
Hey, can you put a lid on it?
Hey.
I'm just kidding, Matt. Go ahead. Go ahead, Rev. Go ahead,
Rev.
We
don't actually have the phone. We just got that, you know, your styrofoam cup with the string.
I wish you hadn't said that. You know, folks, it's true. We've got a hogophone in here in the studio. Why do you have to give that kind of thing away, man? Yeah, what we've got.
Hey, I believe in full transparency.
We've got. Actually, he's not telling the truth, folks. Actually, what we have is we have two tin cans and a wire between them.
That's how we get in touch with Chris when we're not in the studio.
Yeah, we reach him on the hogophone.
Wait, I've never seen this. I just knew we had two Hadels that we hit with sticks repeatedly.
And they run messages back and forth.
Like, we hit one Hadel six times to say hello, and then you at the other end of the hall hit it again, and we reciprocate back and forth because we can only understand Hadel grunts because they carry at subsonic levels that can, you know, go through the tunnels that our voices can't.
Oh, goodness. Rest assured, no Hadels were harmed in the broadcast of the Graylian Report this evening.
Whatever. They've got rocky backs. They can take it.
Now everybody's wondering why the hell, like, two of us are just standing at opposite ends of, like, a hall and just sending this little creature back and forth.
No,
like,
no, there's just, two creatures. You have a creature, I have a creature. We beat them about the head and neck.
This is a primitive intercom
system.
Their
skin is made of rock. They don't feel pain. They just feel a nudge, basically.
They are stony,
like,
little buggers, aren't
it's
they?
It's like poking a callus. It doesn't really hurt.
Yeah, and you know, I actually saw something really creepy. You know, one of them got into a dispute with another the other day. And over something like some lichen or something that they'd found growing on a rock that they liked to eat. And one of these Hadels grabbed at the other's hand and literally tore one of the guy's fingers off. That same Hadel was hanging around outside the studio the other day, and the finger was growing back. Talk about Croctober. That is creepy. Those things can regenerate. Weird. Anyway, you see what we're up against down here, broadcasting from the Hollow Earth? You know, eventually we might actually move this operation back up onto the above ground. You know, okay, we've been...
I like it down here.
I like it down here, too, but we've actually had the bunker since late 1999, and the reason why is because Y2K. I was convinced Y2K was going to be the end of the world, and, yeah... And so I took the family fortune, and we literally invested in...
Squandered it
in building a bunker, you know, that was literally hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface, so that, you know, the harmful effects of radiation and nuclear proliferation and Y2K wouldn't, you know, decimate us down here under the Hollow Earth. And here we are today, you know, and so when I realized that there was really no danger, I spent 3 years living underground. You know, I thought, you know, I was going to come back out, you know, years later, and I'd be the last surviving member of the human race. And turns out that's not the case. I made friends with all these Hadels and everything, and came back out, and nothing had changed. Y2K was a bust, and so I thought we've got to make good use of this bunker. And we built the broadcast facility that we use down here now. And of course, you know, there's the what do you call it? I guess the front piece, the Graylian International building on you know, the terrestrial level of things.
The facade,
yes, which is actually a really nice building. You know, glass windows, plants, and things like that. The lovely Holly working our receptionist desk,
but nearly completely uninhabited.
Yeah, there are people in there. I mean, there's
mostly accounting stuff.
You know what we should do once the singularity comes? You know, don't do it to Holly if she doesn't want it done, but. You know, to give her a couple days off, because she works, like, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
She's the hardest working secretary in radio.
I mean, she's always here. We should make a Holly bot that can sit at the, the
reception
area.
Sounds very festive.
I want a Holly bot.
A Holly bot that'll sit there and, you know, answer the phones and take messages so Holly can actually have a life and, you know, get up and go to the bathroom. She has to use the bathroom at the desk.
No, she doesn't. That's not true. That's not true at all.
That's what she told me.
Well, she's kidding. She gets lunch breaks. She gets everything. Holly...
she sass-mouthed me, basically.
You don't think Holly would do that, do you? Hey, sweetheart. you don't think Holly would sass-mouth?
I don't think she knows that I know who she works for.
We know who Holly works for. We should get that audio. Yeah, we have some rather cryptic audio of Holly. From one of our many outings, we'd attended a conference, I think in Atlanta, Georgia, and Holly had gotten separated from a few of us and everything. Now she made her way back. I might say that there were some libations, you know, consumed that evening in the way of you know, mixed drinks and things like that. But Holly was upset because some of the people who were attending the conference didn't know who she worked for. By God, everybody knows who Micah Hanks is. Yeah, maybe we'll get that audio, but. Hey, sweetheart. She's going to kill us, you know. Oh, bless her heart. We give her a hard time. But, yeah, the hardest working receptionist in Gradio land, Miss Holly, we shouldn't give her last name out. You know, at least let her have that. But that said, moving right along to, we've already talked about, let's see, her cipher codes and Abe Lincoln's nose. What else? There was something else that we were going to touch on here that was newsworthy. That's right. Giant amoebas. Okay. The largest single-celled organism on planet Earth. How large would you estimate it would be, fellas? Imagine the largest single-celled organism. Now, probably you're thinking something microscopic, right? You're going to think of something that's fairly small. Get this. Scientists have discovered a community of 4-inch amoebas that are living at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, the deepest known part of the world's oceans. Imagine one of these guys, okay? And actually, this article at the Christian Science Monitor that I'm looking at actually features one of these things. It shows an amoeba, and it says, imagine one of these, but only 100 times bigger. That's what scientists have found at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, the deepest known part of the world's oceans. Literally, they're talking about 4-inch amoebas. During a July 2011 voyage to the Pacific Ocean chasm, researchers with Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the UC San Diego and National Ocean or Geographic Engineers deployed untethered landers called drop cams equipped with digital video and lights to explore the largely mysterious region of the deep sea known as the Mariana Trench. The team documented the deepest known existence of what are called, get this, xenophyophores, single-celled animals exclusively found in deep-sea environments. Xenophyophores are noteworthy for their size, with individual cells often exceeding 10 centimeters. There's extreme abundance on the seafloor, and their role as hosts for a variety of organisms. Now, these are indeed extreme creatures, and of course, at that depth, it is indeed a very extreme environment. The researchers spotted these xenophyophores at depths of up to 6.6 miles within the Syrena deep of the Mariana Trench. Boy, they think that's deep. They ought to come down to the bunker sometime. The previous depth record for xenophyophores was approximately 4.7 miles. In the New Hebrides Trench, although sightings in the deepest portion of the Mariana Trench have been reported, scientists say that xenophyophores are the largest individual cells in existence today. Recent studies indicate that by trapping particles from the water, xenophyophores can concentrate high levels of lead, uranium, and mercury, and are thus also likely resistant to large doses of heavy metals. They also are well-suited to a life of darkness, low temperature, and high pressure, existing deep within the recesses of the deepest oceans here on terra firma. Fascinating stuff. We're preoccupied so often with life out there elsewhere in the universe, and yet, in the depths of the oceans, who knows what else might be out there? There are 4-inch amoebas. Maybe there's something else. When we come back, we'll talk about somebody else who's fascinated with what might be down there in Earth's oceans. When we come back here on the Gray Alien Report, I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Stay tuned.
Radio. I'm going to clue you into the show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Hannigan. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. When this begins, Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you then.
All right, guys, I know you've been putting it off. Your thirst for knowledge is incredible, insatiable, but your wallet says otherwise. So you haven't been able to subscribe to all those classy magazines out there bringing you to the edges of the fringe just like you and I do every week here on the Gray Alien Report. Well, good news for you. You can now subscribe to Intrepid Magazine for an entire year and just pay $19.95. Really? That's it? It's no joke. $19.95 will get you an entire year of incredible insight from authors like Nick Redfern, Scotty Roberts, and of course yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Visit www.intrepidmag.com today and feel your mind expanding tomorrow.
To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Yeah, while at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, there might be these Boy, I love that word. It's a real mouthful. Xenophyophores. I mean, literally single-celled animals that are 4 inches in diameter. Great big amoebas. Who knows what else might be down there? But I know that this is something that's been of interest not just to us here at the Grayling Report. British tycoon Richard Branson has also proposed, get this, a flying submarine. And on Tuesday, as far as I understand, this was actually this goes all the way back to April of this year, but this was reported on recently, and we're bringing it to you now because I hadn't heard about this yet. We all know Richard Branson, who is behind Virgin Transportation. He's hoping to kind of bring space to the common man. He's hoping to essentially privatize, you know, an industry that will take people into the cosmos. But he's also wanting to take people deep, deep, deep down into the depths of the Earth's oceans. Keep in mind that these xenophorophiles were discovered at a depth of about 6.6 miles, I believe. Well, Branson, okay, back in April, released information about what Virgin has been designing, an oceanic submarine which is capable of diving 7 miles underwater to the very deepest points in the ocean. He's pretty serious about this stuff. As interested as he is in space, apparently he really thinks that, well, going to the depths of the oceans would be just as interesting, if not more interesting. As if the idea of launching himself into outer space on his own shuttle was not exciting enough, the British mogul has now launched a project to ride a one-man submarine to the deepest depths of the ocean, the Christian Science Monitor reported in April. Mr. Branson unveiled Virgin Oceanic, the newest branch of the multifaceted Virgin Group, best known for its music and airline companies. The undersea program aimed to set some 30 Guinness World Records as it makes 5 dives in 5 oceans over 2 years and the world's only submarine capable of taking a human to the bottom of each sea. What if I were to tell you about a planet inhabited by intelligent beings that had, in the 21st century, physically explored 0% of its deepest points and mapped only 3% of its oceans by unmanned craft, when 70% of the planet's surface was made up of water, Branson had said on his personal blog at the time. Then I tried to convince you that only 10% of the life forms inhabiting that unknown world are known to those on the surface. You'd think I'd fallen asleep watching the latest sci-fi blockbuster. And then you discover we're talking about planet Earth. Indeed, there very well may be strange things in the depths, the deepest depths of the oceans. Strange, unfathomable things. But there are just as likely probably things out there outside of Earth's atmosphere that would boggle the mind. And some have claimed for a long time that indeed there are humans, people like you and I, right here on Earth, who have had ongoing interactions with strange beings from other planets. And we wouldn't leave you with an entire episode of the Grayling Report without one of Matt, the Reverend Oakley's famous top 10 roundups. Matt, he's been digging around, and he's found another one of these wonderful and zany top 10s this week, featuring a bit of information about how you might better discern if you indeed are a victim of alien abduction. Reverend, take it away.
Hey, thank you. And, yeah, it's time once again. What was that crap you put up on Facebook, Chris, earlier? Boys and ghouls?
Boys and ghouls.
Boils and ghouls.
Oh, yeah, boils and ghouls. I wrote the damn thing. Okay.
Boils and ghouls.
Anyway, Reverend.
Okay, so we've got top 10 signs that you've been abducted by an extraterrestrial.
You're on a ship.
So, number one.
Oh, Matt, did you actually, were you actually hoping to have a drumroll sound?
I mean, it's up to you, really. I could go either way.
Well, keep stalling while Micah gets it.
No.
I mean.
Shut up. I'm not doing anything. He's stalling. The engineer. He's pushing buttons.
Yeah.
By the way, I got a drumroll right here. Here, this is for you, Matt. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Number one. How long is it? Okay, it's done. have you ever experienced any periods of missing time? Periods that can not be accounted for? And this is not to be confused with high time, borrowed time, bedtime, overtime, killing time, or the like.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I guess.
I mean, Chris?
Does blacking out count?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, too. It doesn't list blacking out, so...
Well, I'll go with no. I have not had periods of missing time.
All right, number two. Do you have any odd markings?
Oh, sorry.
Do you have any odd markings, unusual scars, designs, or wounds for which you have no explanation? Of the many signs of alien abduction, this is probably the most important.
I have a pretty fair amount of designs all over my body.
Yeah.
Tattoos don't count.
But
I don't know. I don't really remember getting some of mine.
I can explain the majority of them.
Go ahead. I'm not stopping you. What? Somebody's got a case of the giggles. Some little boil's got a bad case of the... Sorry, go ahead, Chris. Matt. Okay, anybody.
Take it away.
Matt, it's on you.
I remember most of my tattoos, so...
I want to hear more about alien abduction.
Number three. Have you or are you currently having flying, levitating, falling, or floating dreams? And... if so, is it your belief that aliens were responsible?
No, I was a cow and I fell off a cliff.
If you can't recall, just go ahead and skip to number four, which is what we'll do right now.
Let's go on to number four.
Okay. Do you have a credence to spurious information being posited as credible science?
Credence Clearwater Revival.
What? Yeah, that's a pretty big one.
Could you repeat that one? Sorry.
Do you give credence to spurious information being posited as credible science?
In other words, are you a conspiracy theorist who believes that...
are you us?
I don't think that we give credence to spurious information.
No.
Well, actually, a lot of people would say we do, but... anyway.
They don't listen to the show.
But if that is one of the indicators, if you give credence to spurious information, then, like... 97% of the world's population has been abducted by aliens.
In other words, are you crazy?
Do you believe in silliness?
Do you believe in silliness? Do you think that you probably have had an interaction with extraterrestrial intelligence?
Do you find implants in your body that aren't silicone or saline?
Were you impregnated by Zeta 2 reticulans?
Did you give birth to a lizard? That sounded...
A lizard? A lizard?
Sorry, a lizard.
A lizard?
Yes, a lizard.
Did you give birth to a lizard? Sorry, Matt, go ahead. Chris and I are really mean.
Okay. All right, number five, do you feel as though you are special, you're the special chosen one?
Yes!
Chosen by some unknown cosmic entity.
Yes!
And appointed to save the planet and all of its inhabitants.
Yes! Have you never seen Dragon Ball Z? That's about me. I'm Kakarot. Okay.
Or have you ever felt the compelling desire to join environmental groups who have the same save the planet mentality?
So you're Ralph Nader?
Do you think you're going to save the planet, or are you just kind of like... into recycling.
Al Gore was abducted by aliens.
Hang on.
Damn it.
Save the planet or save the populace? Huge difference.
Yeah, right.
Because I'll save the planet.
But the populace you don't give a crap about,
not
right?
Not at all. Not at all.
Number six. Have you been receiving telepathic messages or channeling entities that claim to be the high priest of some such planet or the overlord of all mankind? Like, or do you believe Cher, Elvis, Queen Elizabeth, and Michael Jackson are reptilian?
Of course they are.
Like, all of them.
Like Pazuzu? Because we have brain chats.
We don't believe... See, we don't believe those things because we accept them as fact, obviously.
Yeah, belief denotes there's room for error there. No, just like you don't believe in evolution. Evolution is. You don't believe Michael Jackson was a reptilian. Michael Jackson was a reptilian.
Duh. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, seven. Do you find yourself spending too much time in the shower dreaming about the mothership?
I don't know if that one...
Does it have to be in the shower? Can it be
couch? Yes, it specifically states in the shower, so it has to be in the shower.
Well, there's other things I guess I could be doing in the shower.
I think about mothers, but not motherships.
Oh, really? I see.
Wow.
Oh, Chris, well...
Number eight. Do you believe that you can safeguard your thoughts from alien super beings by wearing hats made from tinfoil?
You know, there's a very credible website that offers, you know, alien abduction-proof hats.
Is it those, like, skull cap, like, armor
things?
Have you seen the girl who's, like, posing in one? She's like,
I saw
oh, dude, and it's totally, like,
I saw
model
that when
friendly
I was in college.
Yeah.
Like, I saw that years and years ago, and
have to see if I can
the fact that you brought that up just makes me love you that much more.
Yeah, dude, they're hilarious. I mean, it's like the guy who makes them is completely serious. I mean, they look like these little aprons, like with like, you know, like the old school football helmets, you know, that had the little parts that came down, the ear protection, and then the little strap. they're really stylish because they've got the strap that comes down around the chin and everything, and then they've got that, whatever that metallic, whatever it is on the interior and everything. But the people at the website, like, who are modeling them, I mean, they're sitting there wearing this, like, brown sock on their head, and they're like, yeah, look at me. I'm not going to be read, you know, or intruded upon by aliens. Aliens aren't going to find out where I am tonight. So anyway, yeah. And I'm going to get those for you guys for Christmas this year. Matt, we've got about a minute. You got to wrap this up quick, okay, but go for it.
You guys keep interrupting me. And
my bad. Right. What number are you on? All right,
I'm on, let's see, 9. Have you ever experienced any highly vivid or lucid dreams in which you could not move your extremities and were completely helpless while being probed by beings of unknown origin, which had a penchant for making insensitive remarks about your private areas?
God. Everything up until the insensitive remarks.
No, that never happens to me because I wear the patented alien abduction proof helmet. Number 10, Matt.
Number 10, do you recall having been given a tour of crying green-skinned... What the... Okay, I'm making sure I'm reading this right. Do you recall having been given a tour of crying green-skinned 12-eyed babies in a nursery and being informed that they were yours?
Every night.
Every night. And there's actually an 11. Can we, let's...
I'll let you do one more. Right. Bonus round. Right. Bonus round.
Are you unable to control the urge to surf the net for websites on the unexplained, mysterious, and unsolved? Do you root around their forums looking for other people who show signs of alien abduction and find yourself posting information as if you personally knew the aliens yourself? If you show any signs, any or all of these signs of alien abduction, you should know that it is very, very serious. You are probably being repeatedly abducted and probed and sexually assaulted by some alien life forms looking for a way to take over the planet.
And you know what's so
there
sick?
Is nothing that you can do.
Well, then what's the point of giving me a damn list?
Well, knowing my friends is half the battle. That's going to have to wrap it up this week. On behalf of John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, and of course yours truly, the Mouth of the South, and all those of his here at Graylian International Headquarters. We bid you adieu. Until next time, I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. And until we meet again, stay strange out there.